need to speak about inflammation, because there is a possibility that inflammation is behind many of the problems that we are seeing with diabetes, with metabolic syndrome, etc. And this is based on an article in Time magazine. And the article, let me just see if I can find it. I had it here, but it's getting lost. All right, it is in Time magazine. Check with Leah. She has the article. I thought I had it with me, but I do not. She has the article. It was a cover article on inflammation. And this is some of the information which I have gleaned off of the internet and through that article and through going to seminars. And there also is a book on inflammation by Barry Sears, which is very good. So here's some of the new research. The new research is concentrating on chronic inflammation and its effect on the body. What does chronic inflammation do to the body? First, it destabilizes cholesterol deposits in coronary arteries, and so it leads to heart attacks and strokes. Second, it destroys nerve cells in the brains of Alzheimer's patients. Third, it may result in the multiplication of abnormal cells and influence their change to cancer. So, chronic inflammation may actually be behind many of the most feared illnesses of middle and old age. Let's go through a review of the basic immunological response. There's innate immunity. This is the generalized response of the body to any kind of attack, such as trauma, injury, or bacteria. Sentinel cells alert the immune system of the problem and results in the release of histamine from the mast cells. The histamine makes capillaries leaky, slowing down the invading bacteria and allowing other immune cells to get in the area. Other sentinels, macrophages, also attack and release cytokines, which signal the body that more response is needed. Second type of immunity is learned immunity. This directs and intensifies the innate response, creating antibodies to specific organisms. Both types of immunity fight against the pathogens, destroying them and then eventually diminishing the inflammatory response. Problems occur when this inflammatory immune process isn't shut off. Research is in progress to confirm the following very interesting information. Okay, now, first, in heart attacks. Heart attacks are no longer considered to be caused by a clogged artery. Instead, the belief is that the plaque in the artery actually bursts, spewing clots, which cut off artery blood supply. In diabetes mellitus, it is thought that there's a connection between inflammation and fat. Fat cells give off inflammatory cytokines, particularly as one puts on weight. The question is, can treating inflammation prevent diabetes mellitus? We know that losing weight reduces blood sugar. So is there a connection? We know that exercise shrinks fat cells, thus decreasing the number of cells which would give off the inflammatory cytokine. So does exercise itself help us to ward off diabetes mellitus? And there is also research in the area of cancer. When the cells of the body are injured or impaired, the inflammatory response is initiated to heal them. This area may not be an injury, but in fact the beginning of a cancerous growth. In the body's effort to heal it, thus produce inflammation and bring proteins to the area, it could actually be enhancing the growth of the tumor. Another area is in Alzheimer's disease. Through research, it was found that people who took anti-inflammatories developed Alzheimer's disease later than those who didn't take them? Does the body see the damage to the brain as an area in need of the inflammatory response and thus add to the damage? Both aspirin and fish oil reduce inflammatory cytokines, and they thus may reduce a person's risk of Alzheimer's disease. But they do not seem to help once the disease has been discovered. Next, hypertension. Some of the common antihypertensive drugs may work by actually decreasing the inflammatory factors that cause constriction of blood vessels. Next, let's look at oral hygiene. Gum disease is a source of chronic inflammation, perhaps which affects other parts of the body. Does good oral hygiene actually reduce the chance of hypertension, Alzheimer's disease, cancer, etc.? Diabetes and heart attack? This is a new reason to go to your dentist. And then there is research on statin drugs. Statin drugs lower cholesterol, they reduce inflammation, and they also reduce C-reactive protein as well. That is C, capital C, dash, reactive protein. Let's look at what C-reactive protein is. It is a marker of systemic inflammation, which is produced by the liver in direct response to inflammation. The difference between elevated and normal is so small, however, that it must be measured by a high-sensitivity C-reactive protein test. So we need a high-sensitivity one done rather than just a C-reactive protein. A low C-reactive protein is associated with physical activity and weight loss. So the more you do physical activity and more you lose weight, the lower the C-reactive protein. Drugs which lower the C-reactive protein are statins, aspirin, and niacin. So C-reactive protein is a marker of systemic inflammation. So perhaps next time we have physical exams, high-sensitivity C-reactive protein is something you should ask for and encourage your patients to ask for as well, to reflect what's going on in your body as far as systemic inflammation. Okay, I just want to go over in conclusion, what the American Diabetic Association has as their healthy eating plan. They include 3 servings of vegetables, 2 servings of fruits, 6 servings of grains, beans, and starchy vegetables, 2 servings of low-fat or fat-free milk, about 6 ounces of meat or meat substitute, small amounts of fat and sugar, and a total carbohydrate intake of 159 grams or 636 calories, and this does not include any amount of additional sugar. I thank you so much for your attention, and I hope to see you in the nursing building sometime soon. Thank you. First of diabetic nutrition. All diabetics must know how to manage their diets. It requires careful management. The meals should be well balanced, and really a dietitian and physician should work together to create a meal plan the patient can live with and stay with. Now remember, diets of both type 1 and type 2 involve counting grams of carbohydrates. In general, exchange lists are no longer used. So if you hear exchange lists, they're really not used that much. We're counting grams of carbohydrates. Now here are some words of wisdom regarding diabetic nutrition. An easy diet for the diabetic is a meal should include half vegetables, a quarter starch, a quarter meat, fruit and milk. So half of your plate should be vegetables, a quarter starch, a quarter meat, fruit and milk. There should be no hydrogenated fat. They should avoid dried fruits. They tend to be concentrated in their sugar. They should read labels. Concentrate on looking at the carbohydrates in your items of food, not the sugar. And be careful with the labels. If the label says it's sugar-free, guess what? The manager added fat. If the label says it's fat-free, the manager added sugar. Do not buy, teach your patients not to buy expensive dietetic foods. They are expensive and high in sodium. Remember that sugar is not omitted from the diet of the diabetic today. We don't tell them you can never, ever have a piece of cake again. It's just managed. They are to go on no fad diets, and alcohol should be in moderation, maybe 1 to 2 times a week. And that alcohol should be taken with a meal, otherwise it could cause hypoglycemia. And remember, alcohol is not calculated as part of the total carbohydrate allotment of a meal. Okay, exercise in diabetics. After a complete physical, persons may exercise. Okay, begin a regular exercise program. They should not do isometrics, like leaning against a wall, etc., because these tend to increase the pressure, especially in the eye. The benefits from exercise, which everyone experiences, is fitness, enhanced emotional state, weight control, lower cholesterol and triglycerides, and reduced risk of cardiovascular diseases. So everyone gets those benefits. But specifically the benefits from exercise for the diabetics, in addition to what we just said, the exercise causes glucose reduction by increasing the uptake. Exercise causes glucose reduction by increasing the uptake of glucose by the muscle cells, potentially reducing the need for insulin. There are some caveats about exercise and the diabetic. The diabetic should not exercise if the blood sugar is greater than 250 or less than 150. They should not exercise if they are spilling ketones, if they are in pain. Remember, that causes stress. When insulin is peaking, that will lower the glucose even more, or within 1 hour of injection of insulin. They should not exercise if there are retinal problems because there's an increased risk of retinal hemorrhage. They should not exercise sooner than 1 hour after meals. And they should not exercise after taking insulin in a limb. Remember, that increases insulin absorption if they're exercising that limb. Better give it in the abdomen instead if you're going to be exercising. And on exercising, they should check the blood sugar before, during, and 30 minutes after the exercise. And if they're feeling hypoglycemic, they should check their blood sugar. Okay, let's look at the education of the diabetic. Really, becoming a diabetic is an entirely different lifestyle. There's a tremendous amount to learn about your illness and what is occurring in your body. We have diabetic educators who come up on the floors and do education. More and more, however, because hospitals are cutting back, they don't have diabetic educators. It is you. And so, let's see some of the information you are going to give your patient who is a diabetic, or perhaps even you're going to reinforce some of this in someone who is not only a new diabetic, but someone who has been a diabetic for a while. First, they should see an ophthalmologist yearly. An ophthalmologist is an MD. An optometrist is a doctor who is a doctor of optometry. He checks your eyes to see what your prescription will be for eyeglasses, and he checks for pathologies. But he cannot write prescriptions, and he's not an MD. Okay? An optician fixes your glasses and makes them. So an ophthalmologist, you might want to explain those differences. Second, this person who's a diabetic needs to go to a physician who specializes in diabetes, and that is an endocrinologist. This is not a case for going to the neighborhood doctor center to have your diabetes managed. You need someone who is a specialist in endocrinology. Next, no smoking. We talked about the peripheral vascular problems in the diabetic. Well, smoking compounds that dramatically. The person should see a podiatrist about every 3 months to trim the toenails and remove corns and calluses. Remember, this person cannot feel pain, possibly, in the feet. You need to have someone professional dealing with these problems in the foot. Let's specifically talk about foot care, because this is a very big area. First, the person should check the feet every day with a mirror if necessary. You know, if they can't bring the leg up well enough, use a mirror. Check for cracks in the foot, redness, blisters, and palpate for any irregularities. So feel around the foot, any irregularities. Here's where the person might pick up that they have an area of redness from a particular pair of shoes. That area of redness can result in a decrease in blood supply and end up an ulcer, which will result in this person losing their leg. So this is very important. If they are cutting their own toenails, which again we don't suggest, but if they do, cut it straight across. Remember, don't curve in where you might nick the skin, and now we have, once again, an open wound, an ulcer, and an amputation. Check to see that the shoes fit correctly. The shoes should be bought in the afternoon when the feet are swollen, and never wear new shoes all day until they're broken in. These people need to wear white cotton socks and stockings without seams, so that each night when they check their feet, any drainage will be readily visible on those white socks. Also, the cotton tends to keep the feet dry. If the feet perspire, the cotton dries quickly. Never soak the feet. This is not the person to buy a foot bath for, okay? They should dry their feet well after bathing. Patting, not rubbing. They pat the feet, don't rub it. And dry, especially between the toes. Never, ever walk barefoot. You could step on something you don't know you're stepping on, and that can be the beginning of the amputation scenario. If shoes are laced, they're not to be too tight. Again, circulation. A soft rubber crepe sole with leather uppers are best as far as shoes, so make them a soft crepe sole, leather uppers. Plastic shoes are nice and cheap, but they don't allow the feet to breathe. A 1-inch high heel, no higher. If the person has a cut on the foot, it's to be washed with soap and water and dried well, and then call a podiatrist and arrange a visit. They need to check for neuropathy, numbness, tingling, and burning of the feet. And when we do this, we teach the patient to use a monofilament fishing line, you know, the clear fishing line, to poke the foot. They take the little piece of fishing line and they actually poke all around the foot to see if they feel it. And that's how they know whether they have neuropathy. Now, you, as a nurse in the hospital, and as in clinics and whatever, wherever you work, need to observe the feet. First, you need to note the gait. If the person has a problem on their foot, their gait will be out of the ordinary. So then, if you see that, then you have them sit down and you check the feet for pressure points. Next, you need to look for symptoms of Charcot's foot. That's capital Charcot. That's a person's name, a doctor's name. These are flat, swollen feet, which are caused by degeneration of the bones of the feet. They say it looks like your foot looks like a bag of bones. It really has no structure, no arch at all. These are the people who need special therapeutic shoes. Also check for peripheral vascular disease. You need to use your skill in checking peripheral pulses, the temperature of the foot, and capillary refill of the toes. You need to look for dependent rubor. This is when someone is sitting in a chair or at the side of the bed and their legs become a deep red, more purplish. This is a definitive sign of vascular disease. Also look on the legs. Legs that have peripheral vascular disease are hairless and their skin is shiny. And also there are thick nails in the toenails of a person with peripheral vascular disease. So here, coming home to roost, are all of those things we had you learn in your first semester and to observe on every patient you had. Now you're coming to realize why you did all of that. Okay, you also need to educate the diabetic in skin care. Remember, they are prone to itchy, dry skin. Bathing daily is not necessary for these people. You need to teach them to test the water if they're taking a bath with an elbow, not a foot. Remember, the foot is not dependable, and they could be stepping into a very, very hot bath with their feet with peripheral vascular disease. We can have burns. Remember, burns lead to ulceration. Ulceration leads to gangrene. Gangrene leads to amputation. The person should be encouraged to use super fatted soaps. Those are soaps like a Neutrogena soap, the specialty soaps, not deodorant or perfume soaps. They are not to use those. The super fatted soaps tends to, like a lanolin soap, tends to leave some of the moisture in their skin. So they're less prone to that dry, itchy skin. They should also use light-colored towels and washcloths so they can see any drainage from their wounds, particularly the feet. And as far as creams, they should use a lanolin cream on the body. Eucerin, E-U-C-E-R-I-N, is a very good one. But they should not use ones with alcohol, which dry the skin. Also, no cream between the toes. Remember, cream between the toes sets up a moisture situation. A moisture situation can set up an ulcer situation, can set up a gangrene situation, can set up an infection, and then amputation. So I think you get the scenario. Okay, we also need to teach these people about sick days. When they are sick, what do you do as a diabetic? First, teach them that they need to have a contact person to check on this diabetic when they are ill. So this person should have a contact, like a relative, a friend, or neighbor, so that they can have them check up on them. Teach them to call the physician if they're ill. If they start to become sick, they need to contact the physician. They should take their insulin and oral hypoglycemics just as they did before, even if they are not eating, okay? Remember, the blood sugar increases when we are sick or stressed or when we've had surgery. If they are vomiting, they are to take fluids with a small amount of sugar and sodium. They are to monitor their blood sugar at least every 2 hours when they're sick. They should test for ketones if the glucose is above 250. And they should drink 8 to 12 ounces of fluid every hour. Take sips of fluid even if they are vomiting. So clear liquids such as a fruit juice or soda with which has been stirred with a straw so that some of the gas gets out, or gelatin. They are to call the doctor if they are unable to eat for more than 24 hours or they've had nausea and vomiting for more than 6 hours. We also need to talk now about the diabetic patient in surgery, and please read page 973-4 in FIPS 7th edition. Prior to surgery, There needs to be an adequate glucose control. So we need to have the person at 80 to 180. That's an okay range for surgery. Remember, stress raises the level of hormones that affect glucose. This is why a patient with any type of diabetes mellitus is usually on insulin the day of and during surgery and postoperatively, even if they are only taking oral hypoglycemics at home. By the way, the oral hypoglycemics are stopped 72 hours before surgery. Okay? Post-op, you don't want that blood sugar to go below 150 to 250. The person who is post-op may take a combination of NPH and regular insulin. You need to monitor their potassium. And without adequate insulin post-operatively, carbohydrate, fat, and protein metabolism is impaired. Remember that the patient is in a stress-induced catabolic state after surgery, which depletes their protein stores needed for collagen synthesis and wound healing. So they need insulin to heal. Okay. Diabetic medications. Please read about in page 944-5 in FIPS on the oral agents. Remember, your patient still has to manage carbohydrates and exercise while taking meds. We will briefly go over the classifications of drugs which are used, and you need to do your research and fill in the rest of the information about these drugs. Please use your drug book. Sulfonylureas, these increase insulin secretion, and they decrease hepatic glucose production. An example is glipizide, brand name Glucotrol, and gliburide, brand name Diabeta. The problem with this drug is patients are prone to hypoglycemia with these drugs. They're prone to hypoglycemia with these drugs. They are not given in a patient with a sulfa allergy. You'll see the name sulfonylurea. They contain sulfa. Teach them not to take any over-the-counter drugs with this. They may enhance the hypoglycemia without checking with their physician. The next agent is rapid-acting insulin secretagogue. These increase insulin secretion by stimulating the pancreas. An example is repaglinide, or a brand name Prandin. There's less hypoglycemia than with sulfonylureas, and this classification is taken a half hour before meals. The next classification are the biguanides. These decrease hepatic formation of glucose and delay gluconeogenesis, and they increase sensitivity to insulin and increase skeletal muscle utilization of insulin. An example is metformin, or brand name Glucophage. There are many contraindications, and these drugs are not used that often anymore. Next is the alpha glucosidase inhibitor. These delay digestion of ingested carbohydrates, leading to a smaller increase in blood glucose following meals and a decrease in glycosylated hemoglobin. This does not increase insulin secretion. An example is Acarbose, brand name Precoce, and Miglitol, brand name Glycet. These are taken 3 times a day with the first bite of each meal. They are usually taken along with other anti-diabetic meds. They're not used as the only anti-diabetic med. Next is the thiazolidinones, TZDs. Now, these are the upcoming drug here. Put a big star here because these are the good drugs. These resensitize tissues to insulin. They decrease hepatic gluconeogenesis and increase insulin-dependent muscle glucose uptake. Some of the drugs are Rosiglitazone maleate. Brand name, Avandia. Another drug is pioglitazone. Brand name, Actos. These may cause fluid retention, so they are contraindicated in congestive heart failure. These are excellent drugs. Why? Because they also decrease the LDL and increase the HDL. They reduce microalbuminuria. They help to increase nitric acid, which expands blood vessels and decreases blood pressure. They may decrease visceral adiposity, which I spoke to you about earlier. They increase cardiac output and stroke volume. They reduce carotid artery inflammation and decrease intima media thickness. Does this sound like a wonder drug to you? It does to me. The TZDs. Read about them. They should be used as initial therapy for type 2 as early as possible. Okay? And they may prevent metabolic syndrome. I'm going to talk about that next. Metabolic syndrome. What is metabolic syndrome? I'd like you to look on the internet. Look up metabolic syndrome on one of the search engines and read about it. I looked under Cleveland Clinic because this is not readily available in your textbook, and it's somewhat new. So let's take a look at what the Cleveland Clinic had to say about it. What is metabolic syndrome? Metabolic syndrome is a collection of health risks that increase your chance of developing heart disease, stroke, and diabetes. The condition is also known by other names, including syndrome X, insulin resistance syndrome, and dysmetabolic syndrome. According to a national health survey, more than 1 in 5 Americans has metabolic syndrome. The number of people with metabolic syndrome increases with age, affecting more than 40% of people in their 60s and 70s. What are these health risks? You are diagnosed with metabolic syndrome if you have 3 or more of the following. 1, a waistline of 40 inches or more for men and 35 inches or more for women, measured across the belly. This is not the waist. You know, it's measured across the belly. A blood pressure of 130 over 85 millimeters of mercury or higher, a triglyceride level of 150 milligrams per deciliter, a fasting blood glucose level greater than 100 milligrams per deciliter, a high-density lipoprotein level, HDL, less than 40 in men, under 50 in women. Who typically has metabolic syndrome? According to the American Heart Association, 3 groups of people often have metabolic syndrome. 1, people with diabetes who cannot maintain a proper level of glucose tolerance. People without diabetes who have high blood pressure and who also secrete large amounts of insulin, that's hyperinsulinemia, to maintain blood glucose levels. And heart attack survivors who have hyperinsulinemia without glucose intolerance. What are the symptoms of metabolic syndrome? Usually, there are no physical symptoms which are immediate. The syndrome's associated medical problems develop over time. If you are unsure if you have metabolic syndrome, see your health provider. He or she will be able to make a diagnosis. So you see, this is written for the layperson, but it's something we need to know about because we think this is possibly connected with diabetes. So let's take a look at some more information about it. Again, you don't need to copy this all down. If you go to the Cleveland Clinic website, you will be able to get this on metabolic syndrome. What causes it? The exact cause is unknown. Most researchers believe it is caused by a combination of your genetic makeup and lifestyle choices, including the types of food you eat and your level of physical activity. If you have metabolic syndrome, your body experiences a series of chemical, biochemical changes. Over time, these changes lead to the development of one or more associated medical conditions. The sequence begins when insulin, a hormone excreted from your pancreas, loses its ability to make your body cells absorb glucose from the blood. Your body uses glucose for energy. When this happens, glucose remains high after you eat. Your pancreas, sensing a high level of glucose in your blood, continues to excrete insulin. Loss of insulin production may be genetic or secondary to high fat levels with fatty deposits in the pancreas. Consistently high levels of insulin and glucose are linked to many harmful changes in the body, including 1. Damage to the lining of coronary and other arteries, a key step toward the development of heart disease or stroke. 2. Changes in the kidney's ability to remove salt, leading to high blood pressure, heart disease, and stroke. 3. An increase in triglyceride levels, resulting in an increased risk of developing cardiovascular disease. 4. An increased risk of clot formation, which can block arteries and cause heart attacks or strokes, a slowing of insulin production, which can signal the start of type 2 diabetes, a decrease that can increase your risk for heart attack or stroke and may damage your eyes, nerves, or kidneys. How do I prevent or reverse metabolic syndrome? Since physical inactivity and excess weight are the main underlying contributors to the development of metabolic syndrome, getting more exercise and losing weight can help reduce or prevent the complications associated with this condition. Some of the ways you can reduce your risk include losing weight. Moderate weight loss in the range of 5 to 10% of body weight can help restore your body's ability to recognize insulin and greatly reduce the chance that the syndrome will evolve into a more serious illness. 2. Exercise. Increased activity alone can improve your insulin levels. A brisk 30-minute walk a day can result in a weight loss, improved blood pressure, improved cholesterol levels, and a reduced risk of developing diabetes. 3. Consider dietary changes. Maintaining a diet that keeps carbohydrates to no more than 50% of the total calories. You need to eat foods defined as complex carbohydrates, such as whole grain bread instead of white bread, brown rice instead of white rice, and sugars that are unrefined instead of refined sugars, such as in cookies and crackers. Increase your fiber consumption by eating legumes, beans, whole grains, fruits, and vegetables. Reduce your intake of red meats and poultry. As much as 30 to 40% of your daily calories can come from fat, but consume healthy fats, such as those in canola oil, olive oil, flaxseed, and nuts. Limit alcohol intake. Consume no more than one drink a day for a woman, 2 drinks for men. So that is the article from the web on metabolic syndrome. All right, next we need to speak about inflammation, because there is a possibility that inflammation... Let's take a look at the long-term complications of diabetes mellitus. There are lots of changes in the vascular system of the patient with diabetes, and they are thought to be caused by the pathophysiological effects of hyperglycemia. in both type 1 and type 2, and that's often misunderstood by the diabetic. They think that if they have type 2, they're really not in trouble at all, but that is not true. These changes in the vascular system can be diminished or controlled by careful monitoring of blood sugar, diet, medications, but they cannot be completely prevented. And that's very important for you to know. Remember that. They can be diminished or controlled by careful monitoring of blood sugar, diet, and meds, but they cannot be completely prevented. If you have diabetes, you are developing changes in the vascular system. Let's look at the types of complications. The first type is the macrovascular complication. That's the large blood vessels, macro. The first complication is cardiovascular disease. The risk for this is directly related to 1, the increased level of low-density lipoproteins, LDLs. LDLs are the bad cholesterol. The risk is also directly related to the decreased level of high-density lipoproteins, the HDLs, the good cholesterol. It is also related to, third, increased triglycerides. Increased triglycerides are bad. The risk is also related to a sedentary lifestyle, smoking, and hypertension. Cardiovascular disease is 2 times more prevalent in diabetics than in the normal population. Hypertension, twice as prevalent in diabetics than the normal population. And cardiovascular risk is also directly related to obesity. The major problem in cardiovascular disease is atherosclerosis. There is an earlier onset and an increased incidence in diabetes. You know what atherosclerosis is? It's the buildup of the plaque in the artery. Arteriosclerosis is the hardening of the artery. Other diseases which are related to diabetes and to the macrovascular complications, large blood vessels. Whoops, having trouble with the mouth now. Are coronary artery disease, CAD. CAD is the leading cause of death in diabetics, and atherosclerosis is the big problem here. CAD is a major risk factor for myocardial infarction. An MI is 2 to 3 times more common in diabetics, and diabetics have a greater chance of dying after an MI than non-diabetics. Other diseases, cerebral vascular disease. Cerebral vascular disease. And here we're talking about stroke. Stroke is 2 to 4 times more common in patients with diabetes. The major risk factors for stroke are hypertension and atherosclerosis. Another disease is peripheral vascular disease, PVD. The incidence is greater in patients with type 2 diabetes. It's caused, again, by atherosclerosis, and the signs and symptoms are intermittent claudication, C-L-A-U-D-I-C-A-T-I-O-N. This is a cramping and aching of the calf with pain on movement and relief of the pain on rest. These patients are at risk for gangrene, which starts at the toes and the subsequent amputation. The risk of amputation is 10 to 20 times more likely in diabetics. Okay. We talked about the macro complications, the macrovascular complications, the cardiovascular disease, the coronary artery disease, cerebral vascular disease, and peripheral vascular disease. These are all macrovascular complications. Next, let's look at micro vascular. These seem to be related to chronic hyperglycemia, which causes structural defects in the basement membrane of small blood vessels and capillaries. It may also be related to inflammation. And this is under study, and we will be talking about this later on in this lecture. Some of the areas affected by microvascular complications. First, the eye. Here we are discussing diabetic retinopathy. Disease of the retina. This is a collective name for changes which occur in the retina of the diabetic patient. Diabetes is the leading cause of blindness. Diabetic retinopathy is the leading cause of blindness in those aged 20 to 74. Let's look at what the physician sees, or the nurse practitioner sees, in the retina in the patient who has diabetic retinopathy. First, the physician or our nurse practitioner will see hemorrhages in the retina. Second, they will see what we call cotton wool patches. These are white patches on the retina. These are areas of ischemia in the retina due to the decrease in retinal blood flow. They also see neovascularization, neo meaning new vascular vessels and development of. So development of new blood vessels, which form in response to that retinal ischemia. This can result in bleeding in the eye and retinal detachment, which is caused by traction on the vitreous humor. Neovascularization causes fibrous tissue bands to form, and they pull and cause detachment. So that's how it becomes detached. Another finding on assessment of the retina is macular degeneration, and that is when there is central field vision loss. This is another problem with diabetic retinopathy. And another problem is cataracts. Diabetics are at increased risk for cataracts, and it's thought to be from the increased glucose levels within the lung, within the lens. They are also more inclined to develop open angle glaucoma. And you can read about that in your text, and that will be discussed in class. Another area of the body that is affected by microvascular changes in diabetes are the kidneys. And here we are talking about diabetic nephropathy. Nephrons, as in the kidney, diabetic nephropathy. So watch in your reading, we're often talking about diabetic neuropathy, diabetic nephropathy. Neur is the nerves, neph is the kidneys. Renal failure occurs in 46% of patients who develop diabetes before age 20. It is the most common cause of renal failure requiring dialysis or transplantation in the United States. The pathophysiology of diabetic nephropathy: the basement membrane of the glomerular capillaries begins to thicken. This causes an increase in the glomerular filtration rate. Albuminuria is protein that is lost through filtration involving damaged glomerular tissue. Albuminuria may be present very early in diabetic nephropathy. If it's present, it predicts the development of advanced disease later. A low-protein diet may help this. So check when you're doing a check of your lab tests and you see that someone has albumin in their urine. Think of a damaged kidney from whatever cause, perhaps from diabetes. Okay, another part of the pathophysiology of diabetic nephropathy is hypertension. The hypertension which may accompany DM worsens the microvascular complications, especially nephropathy. So treatment of that hypertension is a must, because the hypertension itself can actually increase the microvascular complications. So here you can see where compliance with medications is so important in preventing these problems. All right, next, neurologic complications. And here we have diabetic neuropathy, the result of damage to peripheral and autonomic nerves, which is caused by the effects of metabolic and vascular abnormalities of diabetes. It causes blocked nerve transmission, either decreased or no sensation of all, often described as dying back. Okay? The symptoms first occur in the toe, then the foot, then the leg. It usually progresses as an infection, then gangrene, and then the areas have to be amputated. So literally, it starts at the toe and the leg, the limb, dies back. The ulcers in the feet are present, not only as a result of neuropathy, such as not being able to feel a pebble in a shoe, or maybe a twisted sock, which is causing decreased circulation, or maybe the seam of a sock. But the ulcers in the feet also can be caused by macro and microvascular changes. All of these problems contribute to foot problems in the diabetic. All of this has to do with blocked nerve transmission, dying back of the foot. I took care of a man a long time ago who had diabetes and came to the emergency room with a huge ulcer in his foot. He had walked around all day with a pebble in his foot and had not felt it, and it had ulcerated and damaged his foot. You and I, if we take one step with a pebble in our shoe, we stop wherever we are and we remove the pebble. So this gives you just some idea of the neuropathy that can occur. The nerves can be so severely damaged that someone cannot feel a pebble in their shoe. Okay. The diabetes mellitus also affects the autonomic nervous system. The first effect are on the genitourinary system. And here we need to talk about a neurogenic bladder. In some diabetics, there is incomplete emptying of the bladder due to a loss of sensation. And this leads to urinary tract infection and kidney infection due to urinary retention. Another genitourinary effect of DM is impotence. 50% of men experience this problem. Another effect on the autonomic system is gastrointestinal effects. Neuropathy can cause delayed gastric emptying, so that people have indigestion, nausea, and vomiting. They also tend to have constipation. This is a very common symptom of diabetes caused by hypomotility of the bowel. And then they also might have diarrhea. Another effect on the autonomic system is the cardiovascular effects. Neuropathy may cause a fixed cardiac rate that does not change with exercise. You can imagine this is a real problem. If your heart does not accommodate to the exercise you're doing, you're not getting enough blood flow to your body. It also may cause postural hypotension, resulting in syncope, S-Y-N-C-O-P-E, and falls. So when this person gets up from lying down in the morning and they get up too rapidly, the neuropathy causes an increased amount of blood to the brain, a decreased amount of blood to the brain, and they faint and fall. So we need to teach these people to get out of bed, get out of chairs very slowly so their blood pressure can adapt. Another autonomic nervous system effect are effects on the skin, and that is called anhidrosis, A-N-H-I-D-R-O-S-I-S. This is a lack of perspiration, so the skin dries and cracks very easily. All right, let's take a look at management of diabetes, the nursing and medical care. Hello, my name is Arlene Whitman. I'm on the nursing faculty at Ocean County College. And today I'm going to be talking about diabetes mellitus. This will be a lengthy lecture because diabetes is very complex. And you will have to refer back to your anatomy and physiology book periodically to refresh your memory about some of the functions of the pancreas, for example, and other aspects that we'll hit on shortly. Okay, let's first define diabetes. Diabetes is a condition of relative or absolute lack of insulin, affecting carbohydrate, protein, and fat metabolism. Let's take a look at what absolute insulin deficiency is. It is when the insulin production is insufficient. That's absolute insulin deficiency. Relative insulin deficiency, or insulin resistance, is when insulin is produced that is not active or is destroyed before it can carry out its action. Now, diabetes is not a single disorder. It is actually a group of chronic disorders of the endocrine pancreas and body metabolism. It is characterized by hyperglycemia, hyper elevated, gly, sugar or glucose, emia in the blood, so an elevated blood sugar. Let's take a look at some general information about diabetes mellitus. And I think probably for the rest of the lecture, I'll say DM so that you know what I'm talking about, but I don't have to say that long term. All right. It affects 18 million people in the United States, and one-third of the cases are undiagnosed. It's anticipated that the number will double by 2025. Now, 1 million Americans have type 1 diabetes, which we will define a little later, and 17 million have type 2, and it is actually increasing in children. One of the reasons it's increasing in children, if you think about our life today, is that children have a very sedentary lifestyle. They tend to be inside in the summertime in the air conditioning rather than running around and playing. They tend to eat the food that mom got at BJ's or Costco's, which comes in large amounts. We eat a lot of processed foods today because mom and dad are working and we don't have time to make a real meatloaf. We don't have time to do a lot of the things that are really healthy for us. There is also an increase in diabetes in older adults. More than 20% of people age 65 and older have diabetes. There is also an increased prevalence in minorities. It is more common in African Americans, Hispanic Americans, Native Americans, and Asians. Okay. Insulin-dependent diabetes type 1 diabetes is slightly more common in men. And type 2 diabetes is diagnosed more often in women. It is the sixth leading cause of death by disease in the United States, mostly because of its effect on the cardiovascular system. The effect on the cardiovascular system is that there is an increase in atherosclerosis, coronary artery disease, CAD, and cerebrovascular accidents, CVA or stroke. Actually, people with diabetes are 2 to 4 times more likely to suffer from heart disease and 2 to 6 more likely to have strokes. The complications of diabetes may also affect the kidneys. 25% of all patients on renal dialysis for renal failure are diabetics. The cost of the illness and the loss of productivity is estimated to be $132 billion a year. That's B as in billion. And that's a 2003 statistic. Much of this burden, this financial burden, can be prevented if we have early detection of diabetes, if we have improved delivery of care, and better education of the diabetic for self-care. Why is the prevalence increasing? Why is it more common now to have diabetes? Well, we always have to look at the fact that we have an aging population. We have people who are older and living longer. And as we live longer, more things go wrong. There's also a growth of the populations which are at higher risk. And again, I'm talking about the Hispanics, Asians, and Native Americans. Also, you need to make note that India and China have a higher incidence of diabetes than the United States. Very interesting. Also, there's an increased prevalence because in our society today, we have an increased prevalence of obesity. 65% of adults are obese or overweight. That's a real problem. All right, that's some of the vital statistics about and the trends about diabetes. Now we need to address the pathophysiology, because if you understand how diabetes works, you will be able to better understand the care which we need to give these people. First, we need to recognize that glucose is the major fuel for metabolism in the body, glucose. Now we need to consider the hormones of the pancreas and glucose homeostasis. First, the pancreas produces hormones necessary for the metabolism and cellular utilization of carbohydrates, proteins, and fats. So the pancreas is very important. Now the islets of Langerhans that's the group of cells that produce these hormones for the metabolism and utilization of carbohydrates, proteins, and fats. There are two types of cells in the islets. The first are the alpha cells. The alpha cells produce the hormone glucagon. Let's take a look at what glucagon does. What is the function of glucagon? First, it stimulates glycogenolysis, 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 the breakdown of glycogen in the liver into glucose when it is needed by the tissues. This is rapid and brief. It takes a few hours to occur, and it results in increasing the blood sugar. And this happens first. Okay, glucagon, secondly, stimulates gluconeogenesis, GlucoNeogenesis. This is the formation of glucose from fats, and that's called lipolysis, LipoLysis, and the formation of glucose from proteins, and these are from non-glucose sources. And this happens next. Glucagon regulates liver-mediated mobilization of stored glucose to be used by organ tissues. Now, the stimulation of glycogenolysis, the stimulation of gluconeogenesis, and the function of glucagon are all, these all occur during stress, infection, or severe illness, unless, and thus further contributes to the hyperglycemia. So all of this, the alpha cell stimulation, the production of glucagon, occurs during stress, infection, or severe illness, and it results in hyperglycemia. All right, we talked about the cells of the islets, the alpha cells functioning. Now we need to see what the beta cells do. The beta cells secrete the hormone insulin. The function of insulin is it facilitates the movement by active transport. You remember that from anatomy. It facilitates the movement of glucose across cell membranes into the muscle and fat cells, thus decreasing blood glucose levels. Second, it prevents excessive breakdown of glycogen in the liver and in the muscle. Third, it facilitates lipid formation. Fourth, it inhibits the breakdown of stored fats. And fifth, insulin helps move amino acids into the cells for protein synthesis. So that's a little bit about the pathophysiology. I encourage you to read about that in your chapter, but I have kind of broken it down. I want you to understand that and stop your tape so that you go back and understand that before we go through and talk about the rest of diabetes. Okay. Let's take a look at what the normal blood sugar is. The normal blood sugar, or normal serum glucose, is 70 to 100 milligrams per deciliter. This varies at different times of the day. The normal blood glucose is maintained in healthy people primarily through the actions of both insulin and glucagon. Refer to what I just said previously. Now, today we are looking at the lab work in an interesting way. The physicians feel that a person with a fasting glucose level before breakfast of 100 milligrams per deciliter or higher is now to be treated as a pre-diabetic. Okay, so that's something for us to remember. Okay. The American Diabetes Association has a quote, if the fasting blood sugar is over 100, a person has a 10 to 15% chance of getting diabetes in the next 7 years. So by seeing to it that perhaps the person looks at their diet, looks at their lifestyle, their exercise early, perhaps it will prevent the diabetes from getting out of hand. Okay. If the fasting blood sugar is over 126 milligrams per deciliter on at least two occasions, the person is considered to have diabetes. So let's summarize now what is happening in diabetes. In diabetes, the cells are starving. They're not getting their nutrition in an extracellular pool of glucose because of a lack of insulin. Insulin, remember, is needed to bring glucose into the cell. So what happens is there's glucose in the blood, but it's not in the cell. So when the body reads the cell, they read that there's a glucose lack. So what does the body do? Early on, glycogenolysis begins, where glycogen is broken down in the liver to form glucose. Then later, gluconeogenesis occurs, where glucose is formed from fats and proteins. This increases lipolysis, the breakdown of fats to ketones for energy. So what we have is a body that does not need any more glucose. However, the cells lack the glucose and they call for more glucose to be made. So we have a real problem here when the glucose cannot get into the cell. All right, let's look at the types of diabetes. Let's look at type 1. Type 1 has a rapid onset. It can be at any age, even in the elderly, but it usually occurs before age 30. It is characterized by 1. Hyperglycemia, elevated blood glucose levels. It is also characterized by 2. A breakdown of body fats and proteins, and 3. A development of ketosis, K-E-T-O-S-I-S, an accumulation of ketone bodies produced during the oxidation of fatty acids during lipolysis. It is a result of the destruction of the beta cells of the islets of Langerhans in the pancreas. With these beta cells destroyed, insulin is no longer produced. Now, this is one of the most common, type 1 is one of the most common childhood diseases. This is in 5 to 10% of all diabetes cases. So 5 to 10% of all diabetes cases are type 1. So it's the lesser common of the types of diabetes. Males and females are equal in their incidence of type 1. It's usually in younger people below age 20, but it can be in anyone, 20 or 30. And it's more common in Caucasians. Let's take a look now at the causes of the loss of insulin secretion for a moment. There are various causes why the pancreas would stop producing insulin. Now, these are conjectures. They are not proven yet, but these are some of the thoughts on it. It's thought first that it is an autoimmune response. The immune system attacks and destroys beta cells of the pancreas, which produce insulin. The possible triggering mechanisms of this attack by the immune system might be a combination of genetic and environmental features. Genetic, they're thinking it might be the body's antigens, specifically the human leukocyte antigen, which attacks the beta cells. They also think it might be environmental, such as from viral infections, such as mumps, rubella, and the Coxsackie B4 virus. There's also a possibility that it is chemical toxins, such as those found in smoked and cured meats. So watch that deli counter. Next, there's a seasonal incidence, and so researchers are looking at this. Midwinter and spring are peak times, and these coincide with the high incidence of viral and bacterial infections. So possibly, here's a relation possibly with that viral issue we were just talking about. And there's also a thought about insulin autoantibodies. Insulin autoantibodies. And this is also called peripheral insulin resistance. Insulin antibodies are produced in large amounts, making the insulin less effective. Now, these insulin antibodies are found in 85% of children within 1 to 2 weeks of their diagnosis of type 1 diabetes. And yet, only 1 to 2% of non-diabetic patients have such antibodies. So is this an autoimmune response? Stay tuned, and of course, keep reading your nursing journals, such as the American Journal of Nursing and Nursing 2005. This is where we keep up with our research in what is going on. Okay. Now, let us continue with our type 1 diabetes and look at the manifestations of type 1 diabetes. What do we see in type 1 diabetes? Remember that the signs and symptoms are a result of a lack of insulin to transport glucose across the cell membrane. Okay. The first manifestation, the first thing that we would see is hyperglycemia. This is an excessive amount of glucose in the blood. Hyperglycemia causes serum hyperosmolality. This is an increase in the concentration of dissolved substances, and in this case, that dissolved substance is glucose. What does this hyperglycemia do if it is hyperosmolar? Well, it draws water from the intracellular spaces into the general circulation, which increases the blood volume, which thus increases renal blood flow. This hyperglycemia acts as an osmotic diuretic, and so it increases urinary output. And thus, your patient has one of the common symptoms of diabetes, which is polyuria, a lot of urine being excreted. All right. Another manifestation is glucosuria, GLUCOSURIA. This is when the blood glucose level exceeds the renal threshold for glucose. When the blood glucose level exceeds the renal threshold for glucose, that is usually at about 180 milligrams per deciliter. And when that happens, glucose is excreted in the urine. The third manifestation or symptom is polydipsia, PolyDipsia. That is increased thirst. The decrease in intracellular blood volume and the increased urinary output cause dehydration. So the mouth becomes dry and the thirst sensors are activated and the person becomes thirsty. Next is polyphagia or polyphagia, PolyPhagia. This is an increase in the appetite. Because the glucose cannot enter the cell without insulin, energy production decreases. Decrease in energy stimulates hunger, so the person eats more food. Conversely, now, what you would not think of is another symptom, which is weight loss. Despite this increased food intake from the polyphagia, this person actually loses weight.
The body loses water, and that's the weight that it loses, water weight, from the polyuria. Proteins and fats are broken down then in an attempt to restore the energy sources. So we have a glucose increase, and we have proteins and fats being broken down. Next, another symptom is malaise and extreme fatigue. Remember, this person has a decrease in energy. They don't have that. They don't have that extra glucose, that glucose coming in. Next is blurred vision, and this is from the osmotic effects that cause swelling of the lens of the eye. The treatment for type 1 diabetes is insulin. The person cannot live without it. Let's talk now about type 2 diabetes. Type 2 diabetes is the most common form of diabetes. 90 to 95% of people with diabetes mellitus have type 2. It can occur at any age, but it's usually after age 40. The prevalence increases, however, with age. Remember, there's an increase in Native Americans, African Americans, Hispanics, and Asians. Obesity, sedentary lifestyle, and visceral adiposity are characteristics. All right, what is this? You know obesity. You know sedentary lifestyle. Visceral adiposity is when someone holds most of their fat or a lot of their fat in their belly. So if a person has a waist of greater than 35 inches in females and greater than 40 inches in a male, they are at increased risk for type 2 diabetes. This concept of visceral adiposity is a relatively new one and one you need to pay attention to. And we'll talk about this later on when we discuss inflammation. Type 2 diabetes is an insidious disease. It comes kind of without warning. A lot of people are walking around with it who have no idea that they have it. So there are many, many undiagnosed cases. The blood sugars of those with type 2 improve with weight loss. So we can bring those blood sugars down, the blood glucose down, but they do still have diabetes, even if the blood sugars are within normal range, and the person can do that with weight loss and with diet and exercise. They still have diabetes. The treatment in general for type 2 is diet, oral agents, which we'll talk about later, and or insulin, or all of these. Let's look at the pathophysiology now. Hyperglycemia in type 2 patients probably results from a combination of two things. First is insulin resistance. Another term we used for this is relative insulin deficiency, remember? This may be related to the diminished plasma membrane receptors on target cells. So the insulin cannot attach to the receptor sites. Insulin resistance is specifically related to upper body obesity. And then there is impaired insulin secretion. This person has some endogenous, that means within the body, they have some endogenous insulin, but not enough. So there is limited beta cell response to hyperglycemia. We also have to take, that's the pathophysiology. We also have to take a look at heredity because it does play a role in type 2. There is research that has been done on twins. There is nearly a 100% incidence in twins. So if one twin develops DM, the other will do it also. Also, children of a person with type 2 diabetes has a 15% chance of developing the disease. In type 2, there is no connection with the HLA, the human leukocyte antigen, as there is in type 1 diabetes. That sounds like a test question, doesn't it? Okay. Some of the manifestations or signs and symptoms, of type 2. First, there may be no symptoms. Remember, there is possibly a slow onset. People are often unaware of the disease until they go to get health care for some other problem and perhaps have lab work that discloses this. The major manifestation is hyperglycemia, but it's not as severe as in type 1, but it results in similar symptoms. So the hyperglycemia results in the symptoms such as polyuria, polydipsia. Now, polyphagia is not a usual symptom of type 2, and weight loss is not common. All right, so we have polyuria, polydipsia, blurred vision, fatigue, paresthesias, P-A-R-E-S-T-H-E-S-I-A-S. Paresthesias are numbing and tingling, especially of the feet. And this is from peripheral neuropathy, and we'll talk about that later. Skin pruritus, P-R-U-R-I-T-I-S, that's itching, and frequent infections and slow healing of the cuts and bruises. Also another symptom, recurrent gum, skin, or bladder infections. And lastly, vulvovaginitis. This is someone who has a yeast infection. Specifically, the yeast overgrows in the presence of all of that glucose. So someone who has frequent vaginal infections caused by yeast, one might think about diabetes mellitus. Treatment of type 2 diabetes. Mostly we use oral antidiabetic drugs. 20 to 30% of patients may require insulin. They usually require insulin when they are under stress, either physiological, psychological, with illness, or infection. So your patient in the hospital is someone who might require insulin because their blood sugars rise when they are under stress, the stress of the hospitalization or surgery. So very often you will be ordered to give insulin to someone in the hospital, and when you arrive in the room, you will say, well, I have your insulin for you, and they're going to tell you, I never have taken insulin in my life. And you have to explain that very often when we are under stress, the blood sugar rises and the insulin is necessary. Also, treatment is with diet. Okay, the third type of DM is pre-diabetes. Remember, we've talked about this already. This is impaired glucose tolerance, IGT, and impaired fasting glucose, IFG. These pre-diabetic patients used to be called borderline diabetics. We now call this pre-diabetes. This occurs when the patient's glucose level is between normal and diabetic values. Okay? They are usually obese, and 7% convert to type 2 diabetes eventually. Please look up about impaired glucose tolerance and impaired fasting glucose so that you understand how we test this. Gestational diabetes mellitus, GDM, occurs when there is onset during pregnancy. And I refer you to your maternal and child health book to read further about this. This is in 7% of all pregnancies. This pregnancy is considered to be a high-risk one, and it is defined as carbohydrate intolerance. It disappears after childbirth, but the person remains at high risk to develop diabetes mellitus after pregnancy, and so does her child. Very important. The pathophysiology is that the pancreas cannot tolerate the stress of pregnancy and thus does not respond to the increased demands for insulin. These people with GDM often have a history of unexplained stillborns. And in this case, the acidosis from the diabetes kills the fetus. They also have a history of large babies, which is called macrosomia. Their babies have congenital anomalies, particularly cardiac, and obesity. There also is possibly a history within the family of gestational diabetes, giving us some idea that this might be hereditary. And also cigarette use features in here as a possible cause. So women with cigarette use have a greater chance of developing this. Diagnosis, the screening is at 24 to 28 weeks gestation. And they usually do a 1-hour glucose tolerance test. Please look that up. The treatment of the pregnant woman. The pregnant woman is not treated with oral hypoglycemics because they are teratogenic, teratogenic, meaning they will cause the fetus to be deformed. So the control is done with diet, and they usually have a bedtime snack to prevent hypoglycemia at night. They receive insulin if the diet doesn't control it. The idea is to try to keep the fasting blood sugar around 105 milligrams per deciliter. At each obstetrical visit, the urine is checked for sugar and ketones. And exercise also is part of the treatment. I need to say a word about the renal threshold in pregnant women. Renal threshold is the point at which kidneys will allow sugar to be released into the urine. During pregnancy, the kidneys will spill sugar if the blood sugar is only 130. So it spills urine quite early. So the renal threshold is lower in pregnant women, but remember, it's also lower in young people, and it's higher in the elderly. So the elderly tend to recirculate their glucose and hold it in, which does more damage as well. Just a word now about the pregnant type 1 diabetic. Remember, this person already has DM. The DM should be under control at least 3 months before the patient becomes pregnant. Blood sugar, 70 to 120, should be maintained for a healthy pregnancy. Insulin needs and diet will change during pregnancy, so more insulin might be needed and strict diet control might be required. If the DM is not under control, the newborn or the fetus is at risk for cardiac, central nervous system, and skeletal defects. In all pregnant diabetics, there is a possibility of macrosomia, where the baby has a large body. And what is the deal with this? What's the story? Well, too much sugar in the mom is available, so the baby grows and grows. So the sugar in the blood of the woman allows the baby to grow really much larger than the baby normally would be. This large baby is prone to hypoglycemia. Hypo. Why? The baby's pancreas was working overtime to deal with the glucose from the mom while the pregnancy was taking place. After birth, it continues to produce a large amount of insulin. Too much, actually, for its body now, so it depletes the blood glucose 2 to 4 hours after birth. Also, if the mom has advanced diabetes with vascular changes as a result of the diabetes, this will affect the placental perfusion of blood. So the blood will not be perfused as well in the placenta, and it can cause death of the fetus. And it can also cause congenital anomalies.
Let's take a look at the acute complications of diabetes. Now, again, please go back to your book, to your text, and to your OB book to take a look and read about pregnancy and diabetes. All right, let's do the complications now. The first complication is diabetic ketoacidosis, DKA. It's defined as acute insulin deficiency that causes metabolic acidosis from ketone bodies as a result of fat breakdown. It has a 3 to 10% mortality, seen most frequently in type 1 diabetics. It is a medical emergency. Predisposing factors: first, failure to take insulin. It may occur before the patient realizes they are a diabetic, so they're not taking insulin. A second predisposing factor of DKA is insufficient amount of insulin taken. The third predisposing factor is infection. And the fourth is physiological or emotional stress. This increases the release of gluconeogenic hormones. Okay? The pathophysiology of DKA. There are two major metabolic problems. The first is hyperglycemia. Glucose uptake by insulin-sensitive tissues, such as the liver, skeletal muscles, and adipose tissue, is diminished because of a lack of insulin. So, there is an increase in glucose in the blood. The increased glucose in the blood causes an increase in osmotic pressure, causing fluid to leave the cells and enter the circulatory system. Why are they doing that? In an attempt to dilute the blood. This results in an osmotic diuresis, that polyuria we just talked about. The body is attempting to rid itself of glucose through the urine. But remember that when it does that, it also results in loss of electrolytes, such as sodium, chloride, and potassium. So the body becomes dehydrated. All right, the second major metabolic problem, the first was hyperglycemia, the second is metabolic acidosis. Because glucose is unable to enter the cell, the body attempts to provide more by, remember, the glycogenolysis, the breakdown of glycogen to glucose in the liver, but the body still can't use it because there is no insulin. So the body then reads that it still needs glucose. So gluconeogenesis occurs. This stimulates the formation of glucose from fats and proteins. With an increase in lipolysis, remember that's the decompensation of fats, fatty acid production is increased and ketones are formed when fatty acids are metabolized. Ketones form faster than they can be metabolized or removed by the kidneys. So ketosis or acidosis results. Some signs and symptoms of metabolic acidosis. First is dehydration. Remember, that's due to the osmotic diuretic effect of the glycosuria. So what would the symptoms be of dehydration? Thirst, warm, dry skin with poor turgor. Remember where we check for turgor? Not over the skin of the arm. We check on the inside of the thigh. We check over the forehead, over the sternum, or look at the tongue. If it's a dry tongue, dry and shriveled tongue, the person is dehydrated. Next, we look for dry mucous membranes and sunken eyeballs. Weakness, malaise, rapid weak pulse. So there's tachycardia, and there's also tachypnea and hypotension. These are all part of dehydration. The second sign and symptom is the metabolic acidosis from ketosis. Very often there is nausea and vomiting with this. And of course, this makes the dehydration even more of a problem.
There is also a ketone breath, an acetone breath. It smells fruity. And there's lethargy, which may lead to coma, all part of metabolic acidosis. Please read that in your text as well. Other symptoms of metabolic acidosis: abdominal pain, and there's nothing in the literature to say why that would be. Blurred vision, which may be potassium or magnesium deficiency. Kussmaul's respiration, K-U-S-S-M-A-U-L apostrophe S. Kussmaul's respiration is very characteristic of metabolic acidosis. This is an increased rate and depth of respirations with a longer expiration. The body is attempting to remove ketones through the respiration. This is a compensatory response to prevent further decrease in pH. So we blow off the CO2 to raise the pH. The carbon dioxide, the CO2, is acidic, so you're blowing that off to raise the pH. There also can be coma and death. Let's look at some of the lab data that we might take a look at with metabolic acidosis. First of all, the serum glucose is 300 milligrams per deciliter or higher. The arterial pH is less than 7.3. Remember that normal is 7.35 to 7.45. There is a presence of serum ketones, presence of urine ketones and glucose. The arterial bicarbonate is less than 15 milliequivalents per liter. The normal is 22 to 26 milliequivalents per liter. Remember, the bicarbonate ion attempts to buffer the excessive amounts of keto acids, which are the which cause the metabolic acidosis. This leads to a decrease in serum bicarbonate levels. The sodium-potassium increases. Potassium leaves the cell in the presence of acidosis, and it moves into the blood. It is actually depleted in the body as a whole. Remember, nausea and vomiting also depletes it. So potassium leaves the cell in the presence of acidosis and moves into the blood. So when we measure the potassium in the blood, it's elevated. But it's actually depleted in the body as a whole. Okay, treatment. DKA is a life-threatening emergency. The goal is to lower the hyperglycemia, so we give insulin IV. The insulin which we give IV is regular insulin. Our goal also is to correct fluid and electrolyte balances, return the serum pH to normal, and all of this is accomplished through IV fluids which rehydrate the patient and insulin. The second acute complication of DM is hypoglycemia. Hypoglycemia is a low blood sugar below 60. Remember, our optimum is 70 to 100. And by the way, you will see that number, 70 to 100, different in some of your texts. But 70 to 100 is the most common now. All right, hypoglycemia is actually an insulin reaction. It is a reaction which has a sudden onset and rapid progression. Some of the causes of hypoglycemia: insulin errors, such as the timing or the dose or the wrong type of insulin. Another cause is erratic or altered absorption of insulin. Maybe rapid absorption if the person injects themselves with insulin and goes to the gym and starts exercising with those limbs, or maybe unpredictable absorption from overused injection sites. That is why we rotate our sites. Another cause may be doses of oral hypoglycemics, such as for type 2 diabetics, which are too high for the need. Another cause might be diet, maybe an omitted meal, or maybe an inadequate amount for the meal, or timing errors with late snacks or meals.
Another cause of hypoglycemia might be exercise, maybe unplanned activity when we don't have extra food around or extra insulin around. We have too much insulin. Increased duration or intensity of activity. Alcohol and drugs. Impaired hepatic gluconeogenesis is associated with alcohol intake or impaired mentation from alcohol and drugs. So maybe if someone has had too much to drink or had drugs which alter judgment, the person forgets to take the insulin. Signs and symptoms of hypoglycemia. These are more variable in children and elderly, so keep an eye on these people. But the signs and symptoms are caused by several things, two things. Altered cerebral function, first, due to decreased glucose availability for brain metabolism. So what symptoms would we see in this person with hypoglycemia as far as altered cerebral function? First, circumoral paresthesia, circum, around the mouth, oral. So this is numbness and tingling around the mouth. Headache, difficulty in thinking, confusion, change in emotional behavior, incoherent speech, decreased level of consciousness, seizures, coma. The signs and symptoms Other signs and symptoms are caused by a response of the sympathetic nervous system. I want you to make note that the elderly often do not present with these signs and symptoms. Their sympathetic nervous system is not as finely tuned. So here are some of the signs of hypoglycemia, which you might see in people other than the elderly. Hunger, nausea, anxiety, pallor, cool skin, diaphoresis, tachycardia, heart palpitations, shakiness, and irritability. Treatment. How do we treat hypoglycemia? If you are in doubt as to the cause of the symptoms, we treat for hypoglycemia. Sometimes it looks like it might be hyperglycemia. We usually treat for hypoglycemia. If the person is awake, we give them 4 ounces of orange juice. Don't put any extra sugar in the orange juice, please. If you work with older nurses, they're going to want to open up 4 packets of sugar and put them in. Not necessary. That's what we used to be taught. 3 hard candies or 3 glucose tablets. We always teach diabetics to have hard candies on their person so that they can counter this if it does happen. You need to check the blood sugar, then give a meal with crackers, milk, and something substantial. Improvement should be seen in 5 to 10 minutes. If there is none, repeat the above treatment with the orange juice, etc. If they're unconscious or unable to swallow, there are meds which we give. We give glucagon, IV, IM, or a sub-Q. Works within 15 minutes, and families need to be taught about this. We can also give glucose, a 50% solution, and it's administered at 20 to 50 milliliters IV push. Now be careful here. There's a danger of over-treatment with creating hyperglycemia, so we need to be cautious here. Your nursing care, position your patient to maintain an airway, and you know that's usually side-lying. Remember that glucagon causes nausea and vomiting, so that's an even more important point for the side-lying position. We're giving glucagon, it may very often causes nausea and vomiting. When the person awakens, give them a simple sugar, check the blood sugar, and then the crackers and the milk. Teaching, again, to carry a simple sugar. Sometimes a tube of icing from the grocery store is a good idea, a sugar packet, or Lifesavers. In order to kind of reverse the hypoglycemia, you usually need about 7 Lifesavers, so you need really a nice fresh packet. Okay, so we've talked about DKA, we've talked about hypoglycemia as a complication of DM. The third acute complication of DM is, now, I'm going to say it slowly because it's quite a mouthful, hyperglycemic, hyperosmolar, non-ketotic coma, HHNC. This is seen more in type 2 diabetics. The person is usually classified as a mild diabetic and is treated with oral hypoglycemics. It's also seen in patients who are not yet diagnosed with DM. They don't know they have it. It's also seen with other conditions such as severe infection, acute pancreatitis, myocardial infarction, hyperalimentation, and drugs such as Dilantin, beta blockers, and calcium channel blockers. There's a gradual onset of HHNC, 24 hours to 2 weeks. More common in people greater than 50 years, and it's often confused with a stroke. The mortality rate is 40 to 70%, quite a bit higher than DKA, by the way. All right, what are the characteristics? Severe dehydration. This is a fluid deficit of 8 to 9 liters. Second, severe hyperglycemia. This is a glucose of 600 to 2,000 milligrams per deciliter. Another characteristic is plasma hyperosmolality. Remember, it increases with dehydration. And changed mental status is another characteristic. Remember, there is no ketoacidosis with HHNC. Let's look at the lab data that we might see. We'll see the glucose being very high, 600 to 2,000. Remember, we'll look at the osmolarity. The serum osmolarity will be greater than 350. Milliosmoles. The normal is 285 to 295. These two lab tests, the glucose and the serum osmolarity, are definitive for diagnosis of HHNC. Now, who is at risk for HHNC? The elderly are at risk particularly. They have a decreased thirst perception. You know that their hypothalamus does not work as well. So they very often get in trouble with dehydration, because when you and I become dehydrated, we experience thirst. The elderly do not. They can be severely dehydrated and still not have thirst. Okay. Also, why are the elderly at risk for HHNC? Because their kidneys have a decreased ability to concentrate urine when the body is dehydrated. So they lose fluid anyway. Remember, babies, infants, and the elderly cannot concentrate urine when they become dehydrated. So their kidneys cannot retain the fluid and concentrate the urine and make it darker. So they lose that fluid, even if they are dehydrated. So these two things combine to increase the chance of HHNC in the elderly: the decreased thirst perception and the inability to concentrate urine when the body is dehydrated. Let's look at the pathophysiology of HHNC. It starts with a decreased amount of insulin. Hyperglycemia causes increased urinary output, remember? This results in a decrease in plasma volume, which results in a decrease in the glomerular filtration rate, the GFR. So the glucose is retained and water is lost. The glucose accumulates in the blood and results in increased blood osmolarity. This increased osmolarity pulls water from the cells, remember, into the circulation. And this results in severe dehydration. Remember, the water moves from the cells into the intravascular space. Intracellular water is reduced in all body tissues, including the brain. So what signs and symptoms might we see? Well, dry skin, mucous membranes, and extreme thirst. Polyuria, altered level of consciousness, ranging from lethargy to confusion to coma. We will also see neurologic changes, such as hyperthermia, so their temperature might rise. Motor and sensory impairments, such as reversible hemiparesis, and seizures. They might actually have a grand mal seizure. Treatment. First and foremost is fluid replacement. The fluid replacement is to correct the hyperosmolality and dehydration. We also need to correct the fluid and electrolyte imbalances of sodium, chloride, and potassium. We also need to give them insulin and treat any underlying conditions which might have resulted in this problem occurring. Either the infection, treat the infection, treat the pancreatitis, take a look at the drugs. Any of these might have caused the HHNC. Please look up dawn phenomenon and Somogyi phenomenon and know them, please. They're on page 966 in Phipps, 7th edition. Dawn, as in dawn's early light, dawn phenomenon and Somogyi phenomenon. Okay. Let's look at some of the lab tests for diabetes. I want you to research the fasting blood sugar and glucose tolerance tests. There are different hours. There's 1 hour, 2 hour, etc. Please look those up. Now, tests to monitor diabetes management. First test we use is glycated or glycosylated hemoglobin. Glycated or glycosylated hemoglobin. That's HbA1c. Normal is 4 to 8%. This indicates the control of glucose levels during the past 100 to 120 days. Glycosylated is hemoglobin. When we talk about glycosylated hemoglobin, that's hemoglobin with glucose attached. Okay? When the glucose is elevated, or the control of the glucose is erratic, the glucose attaches to the hemoglobin molecule and remains attached for the life of the hemoglobin, which is about 120 days. The rate at which the glucose becomes attached to the hemoglobin molecule depends on the blood sugar. So these results cannot be changed or affected by what the patient eats before the test, unlike the fasting blood sugar. So this person going to the doctor can't suddenly have their glucose in good control for the couple of days before their doctor's visit. This tells the doctor whether or not this patient has been cheating for all those 100 to 100 days and how well they've been managing their blood sugar. It's a very good test. So it's long-term glucose monitoring. All right, the second type of test to monitor diabetes management is capillary blood glucose monitoring. And we also call it SMBG, self-monitoring of blood glucose. This is used by patients with both type 1 and type 2 diabetes. The blood may be tested 4 to 6 times a day, or maybe once daily or weekly. It's really highly individualized according to the specific patient. The benefits of this self-blood glucose monitoring, it prevents short and long-term complications of DM. It also promotes health and well-being by euglycemia, euglycemia. That's a blood sugar within normal range. It allows the patient to respond immediately to the blood glucose reading that they get. So if it's high, they can do things about it. If they're visually impaired, some of the units have beeps or a voice recording of
the glucose. So you don't necessarily have to have excellent eyesight to do this. Some of the problems are it is expensive, and the machines need to be calibrated and cleaned regularly. Also, it does not test for ketones. That needs to be done separately. The procedure, you wash hands with soap and water. In the hospital, you use the alcohol swab and you let it air dry. The swab is not necessary at home. Remember, the home is a very different place from the hospital. Lots of different types of organisms in the hospital versus the home. So we don't often have to be as careful at home. Just have your patient wash hands with soap and water. Squeeze the finger for 3 seconds with the hand down and relaxed. Pierce the side of the fingertip. The side of the fingertip has fewer nerve endings than the tip. The tip really hurts. If you go to the side, it's less painful. We need a big drop of blood to cover the area of drop placement. If the capillary blood glucose is greater than 250, we test for ketones with a urine dipstick, a keto stick. If the ketones persist with a normal glucose, then we might have a problem such as DKA, and the patient should see a physician. Let's take a look at the long-term complications of diabetes mellitus. There are lots of changes in the vascular system of the patient with diabetes, and they are thought to be caused by the pathophysiological effects of hyperglycemia in both type 1 and type 2, and that's often misunderstood by the diabetic. They think that if they have type 2, they're really not in trouble at all, but that is not true. These changes in the vascular system can be diminished or controlled by careful monitoring of blood sugar, diet, medications, but they cannot be completely prevented. And that's very important for you to know. Remember that. They can be diminished or controlled by careful monitoring of blood sugar, diet, and meds, but they cannot be completely prevented. If you have diabetes, you are developing changes in the vascular system. Let's look at the types of complications. The first type is the macrovascular complication. That's the large blood vessels, macro. The first complication is cardiovascular disease. The risk for this is directly related to 1, the increased level of low-density lipoproteins, LDLs. LDLs are the bad cholesterol. The risk is also directly related to the decreased level of high-density lipoproteins, the HDLs, the good cholesterol. It is also related to, third, increased triglycerides. Increased triglycerides are bad. The risk is also related to a sedentary lifestyle, smoking, and hypertension. Cardiovascular disease is 2 times more prevalent in diabetics than in the normal population. Hypertension, twice as prevalent in diabetics than the normal population. And cardiovascular risk is also directly related to obesity. The major problem in cardiovascular disease is atherosclerosis. There is an earlier onset and an increased incidence in diabetes. You know what our atherosclerosis is? It's the buildup of the plaque in the artery. Arteriosclerosis is the hardening of the artery. Other diseases which are related to diabetes and to the macrovascular complications, large blood vessels. Whoops, having trouble with the mouth now. Are coronary artery disease, CAD. CAD is the leading cause of death in diabetics, and atherosclerosis is the big problem here. CAD is a major risk factor for myocardial infarction,
an MI is 2 to 3 times more common in diabetics, and diabetics have a greater chance of dying after an MI than non-diabetics. Other diseases, cerebral vascular disease. And here we're talking about stroke. Stroke is 2 to 4 times more common in patients with diabetes. The major risk factors for stroke are hypertension and atherosclerosis. Another disease is peripheral vascular disease, PVD. The incidence is greater in patients with type 2 diabetes. It's caused, again, by atherosclerosis, and the signs and symptoms are intermittent claudication, C-L-A-U-D-I-C-A-T-I-O-N. This is a cramping and aching of the calf with pain on movement and relief of the pain on rest. These patients are at risk for gangrene, which starts at the toes and the subsequent amputation. The risk of amputation is 10 to 20 times more likely in diabetics. Okay. We talked about the macro complications, the macrovascular complications, the cardiovascular disease, the coronary artery disease, cerebral vascular disease, and peripheral vascular disease. These are all macrovascular complications. Next, let's look at microvascular. These seem to be related to chronic hyperglycemia, which causes structural defects in the basement membrane of small blood vessels and capillaries. It may also be related to inflammation, and this is under study, and we will be talking about this later on in this lecture. Some of the areas affected by microvascular complications. First, the eye. Here we are discussing diabetic retinopathy. Disease of the retina. This is a collective name for changes which occur in the retina of the diabetic patient. Diabetes is the leading cause of blindness, not baldness. Diabetic retinopathy is the leading cause of blindness in those aged 20 to 74. Let's look at what the physician sees, or the nurse practitioner sees, in the retina in the patient who has diabetic retinopathy. First, the physician or our nurse practitioner will see hemorrhages in the retina. Second, they will see what we call cotton wool patches. These are white patches on the retina. These are areas of ischemia in the retina due to the decrease in retinal blood flow. They also see neovascularization, neo meaning new vascular vessels, and development of. So development of new blood vessels, which form in response to that retinal ischemia. This can result in bleeding in the eye and retinal detachment, which is caused by traction on the vitreous humor. Neovascularization causes fibrous tissue bands to form, and they pull and cause detachment. So that's how it becomes detached. Another finding on assessment of the retina is macular degeneration, and that is when there is central field vision loss. This is another problem with diabetic retinopathy. And another problem is cataracts. Diabetics are at increased risk for cataracts, and it's thought to be from the increased glucose levels within the lung, within the lens. They are also more inclined to develop open angle glaucoma. And you can read about that in your text, and that will be discussed in class. Another area of the body that is affected by microvascular changes in diabetes are the kidneys. And here we are talking about diabetic nephropathy. Nephrons, as in the kidney. Diabetic nephropathy. So watch in your reading, we're often talking about diabetic neuropathy, diabetic nephropathy. Neuro is the nerves, neph is the kidneys. Renal failure occurs in 46% of patients who develop diabetes before age 20. It is the most common cause of renal failure requiring dialysis or transplantation in the United States. The pathophysiology of diabetic nephropathy: the basement membrane of the glomerular capillaries begins to thicken. This causes an increase in the glomerular filtration rate. Albuminuria is protein that is lost through filtration involving damaged glomerular tissue. Albuminuria may be present very early in diabetic nephropathy. If it's present, it predicts the development of advanced disease later. A low-protein diet may help this. So check when you're doing a check of your lab tests and you see that someone has albumin in their urine. Think of a damaged kidney from whatever cause, perhaps from diabetes. Okay, another part of the pathophysiology of diabetic nephropathy is hypertension. The hypertension which may accompany DM worsens the microvascular complications, especially nephropathy. So treatment of that hypertension is a must, because the hypertension itself can actually increase the microvascular complications. So here you can see where compliance with medications is so important in preventing these problems. All right, next, neurologic complications. And here we have diabetic neuropathy, the result of damage to peripheral and autonomic nerves, which is caused by the effects of metabolic and vascular abnormalities of diabetes. It causes blocked nerve transmission, either decreased or no sensation of all, often described as dying back. Okay? The symptoms first occur in the toe, then the foot, then the leg. It usually progresses as an infection, then gangrene, and then the areas have to be amputated. So literally, it starts at the toe and the leg, the limb, dies back. Hello, my name is Arlene Whitman. I'm on the nursing faculty at Ocean County College. And today I'm going to be talking about diabetes mellitus. This will be a lengthy lecture because diabetes is very complex. And you will have to refer back to your anatomy and physiology book periodically to refresh your memory about some of the functions of the pancreas, for example, and other aspects that we'll hit on shortly. Okay, let's first define diabetes. Diabetes is a condition of relative or absolute lack of insulin, affecting carbohydrate, protein, and fat metabolism. Let's take a look at what absolute insulin deficiency is. It is when the insulin production is insufficient. That's absolute insulin deficiency. Relative insulin deficiency, or insulin resistance, is when insulin is produced that is not active or is destroyed before it can carry out its action. Now, diabetes is not a single disorder. It is actually a group of chronic disorders of the endocrine pancreas and body metabolism.
It is characterized by hyperglycemia, hyper elevated, gly, sugar or glucose, emia in the blood, so an elevated blood sugar. Let's take a look at some general information about diabetes mellitus. And I think probably for the rest of the lecture I'll say DM so that you know what I'm talking about, but I don't have to say that long term. All right. It affects 18 million people in the United States, and one-third of the cases are undiagnosed. It's anticipated that the number will double by 2025. Now, 1 million Americans have type 1 diabetes, which we will define a little later, and 17 million have type 2, and it is actually increasing in children. One of the reasons it's increasing in children, if you think about our life today, is that children have a very sedentary lifestyle. They tend to be inside in the summertime in the air conditioning rather than running around and playing. They tend to eat the food that mom got at BJ's or Costco's, which comes in large amounts. We eat a lot of processed foods today because mom and dad are working and we don't have time to make a real meatloaf. We don't have time to do a lot of the things that are really healthy for us. There is also an increase in diabetes in older adults. More than 20% of people age 65 and older have diabetes. There is also an increased prevalence in minorities. It is more common in African Americans, Hispanic Americans, Native Americans, and Asians. Insulin-dependent diabetes, type 1 diabetes, is slightly more common in men. And type 2 diabetes is diagnosed more often in women. It is the sixth leading cause of death by disease in the United States, mostly because of its effect on the cardiovascular system. The effect on the cardiovascular system is that there is an increase in atherosclerosis, coronary artery disease, CAD, and cerebrovascular accidents, CVA or stroke. Actually, people with diabetes are 2 to 4 times more likely to suffer from heart disease and 2 to 6 more likely to have strokes. The complications of diabetes may also affect the kidneys. 25% of all patients on renal dialysis for renal failure are diabetics. The cost of the illness and the loss of productivity is estimated to be $132 billion a year. That's B as in billion. And that's a 2003 statistic. Much of this burden, this financial burden, can be prevented if we have early detection of diabetes, if we have improved delivery of care, and better education of the diabetic for self-care. Why is the prevalence increasing? Why is it more common now to have diabetes? Well, we always have to look at the fact that we have an aging population. We have people who are older and living longer. And as we live longer, more things go wrong. There's also a growth of the populations which are at higher risk. And again, I'm talking about the Hispanics, Asians, and Native Americans. Also, you need to make note that India and China have a higher incidence of diabetes than the United States. Very interesting. Also, there's an increased prevalence because in our society today, we have an increased prevalence of obesity. 65% of adults are obese or overweight. That's a real problem. All right, that's some of the vital statistics about and the trends about diabetes. Now we need to address the pathophysiology, because if you understand how diabetes works, you will be able to better understand the care which we need to give these people. First, we need to recognize that glucose is the major fuel for metabolism in the body. Glucose. Now we need to consider the hormones of the pancreas and glucose homeostasis. First, the pancreas produces hormones necessary for the metabolism and cellular utilization of carbohydrates, proteins, and fats. So the pancreas is very important. Now the islets of Langerhans that's the group of cells that produce these hormones for the metabolism and utilization of carbohydrates, proteins, and fats. There are two types of cells in the islets. The first are the alpha cells. The alpha cells produce the hormone glucagon. Let's take a look at what glucagon does. What is the function of glucagon? First, it stimulates glycogenolysis, 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 the breakdown of glycogen in the liver into glucose when it is needed by the tissues. This is rapid and brief. It takes a few hours to occur, and it results in increasing the blood sugar. And this happens first. Okay, glucagon secondly stimulates gluconeogenesis, gluconeogenesis. This is the formation of glucose from fats, and that's called lipolysis, L-I-P-O-L-Y-S-I-S, and the formation of glucose from proteins. And these are from non-glucose sources. And this happens next. Glucagon regulates liver-mediated mobilization of stored glucose to be used by organ tissues. Now, the stimulation of glycogenolysis, the stimulation of gluconeogenesis, and the function of glucagon all occur during stress, infection, or severe illness, and thus further contributes to the hyperglycemia. So all of the alpha cell stimulation, the production of glucagon occurs during stress, infection, or severe illness, and it results in hyperglycemia. All right, we talked about the cells of the islets, the alpha cells functioning. Now we need to see what the beta cells do. The beta cells secrete the hormone insulin. The function of insulin is it facilitates the movement by active transport, you remember that from anatomy, it facilitates the movement of glucose across cell membranes into the muscle and fat cells, thus decreasing blood glucose levels. Second, it prevents excessive breakdown of glycogen in the liver and in the muscle. Third, it facilitates lipid formation. Fourth, it inhibits the breakdown of stored fats. And fifth, insulin helps move amino acids into the cells for protein synthesis. So that's a little bit about the pathophysiology. I encourage you to read about that in your chapter, but I have kind of broken it down. I want you to understand that and stop your tape so that you go back and understand that before we go through and talk about the rest of diabetes. Okay. Let's take a look at what the normal blood sugar is. The normal blood sugar, or normal serum glucose, is 70 to 100 milligrams per deciliter. This varies at different times of the day. The normal blood glucose is maintained in healthy people primarily through the actions of both insulin and glucagon. Refer to what I just said previously. Now, today we are looking at the lab work in an interesting way. The physicians feel that a person with a fasting glucose level before breakfast of 100 milligrams per deciliter or higher is now to be treated as a pre-diabetic. Okay, so that's something for us to remember. Okay. The American Diabetes Association has a quote, if the fasting blood sugar is over 100, a person has a 10 to 15% chance of getting diabetes in the next 7 years. So by seeing to it that perhaps the person looks at their diet, looks at their lifestyle, their exercise early, perhaps it will prevent the diabetes from getting out of hand. Okay. If the fasting blood sugar is over 126 milligrams per deciliter on at least two occasions, the person is considered to have diabetes. So let's summarize now what is happening in diabetes. In diabetes, the cells are starving. They're not getting their nutrition in an extracellular pool of glucose because of a lack of insulin. Insulin, remember, is needed to bring glucose into the cell. So what happens is there's glucose in the blood, but it's not in the cell. So when the body reads the cell, they read that there's a glucose lack. So what does the body do? Early on, glycogenolysis begins, where glycogen is broken down in the liver to form glucose. Then later, gluconeogenesis occurs, where glucose is formed from fats and proteins. This increases lipolysis, the breakdown of fats to ketones for energy. So what we have is a body that does not need any more glucose. However, the cells lack the glucose and they call for more glucose to be made. So we have a real problem here when the glucose cannot get into the cell. All right, let's look at the types of diabetes. Let's look at type 1. Type 1 has a rapid onset. It can be at any age, even in the elderly, but it usually occurs before age 30. It is characterized by 1. Hyperglycemia, elevated blood glucose levels. It is also characterized by 2, a breakdown of body fats and proteins, and 3, a development of ketosis, K-E-T-O-S-I-S, an accumulation of ketone bodies produced during the oxidation of fatty acids during lipolysis. It is a result of the destruction of the beta cells of the islets of Langerhans in the pancreas. With these beta cells destroyed, insulin is no longer produced. Now, this is one of the most common, type 1 is one of the most common childhood diseases. This is in 5 to 10% of all diabetes cases. So 5 to 10% of all diabetes cases are type 1. So it's the lesser common of the types of diabetes. Males and females are equal in their incidence of type 1. It's usually in younger people below age 20. But it can be in anyone, 20 or 30. And it's more common in Caucasians. Let's take a look now at the causes of the loss of insulin secretion for a moment. There are various causes why the pancreas would stop producing insulin. Now, these are conjectures. They're not proven yet, but these are some of the thoughts on it. It's thought first that it is an autoimmune response. The immune system attacks and destroys beta cells of the pancreas, which produce insulin. The possible triggering mechanisms of this attack by the immune system might be a combination of genetic and environmental features. Genetic, they're thinking it might be the body's antigens, specifically the human leukocyte antigen, which attacks the beta cells. They also think it might be environmental, such as from viral infections, such as mumps, rubella, and the Coxsackie B4 virus. There's also a possibility that it is chemical toxins, such as those found in smoked and cured meats. So watch that deli counter. Next, there's a seasonal incidence, and so researchers are looking at this. Midwinter and spring are peak times, and these coincide with the high incidence of viral and bacterial infections. So possibly, here's a relation possibly with that viral issue we were just talking about. And there's also a thought about insulin autoantibodies. Insulin autoantibodies. And this is also called peripheral insulin resistance. Insulin antibodies are produced in large amounts, making the insulin less effective. Now, these insulin antibodies are found in 85% of children within 1 to 2 weeks of their diagnosis of type 1 diabetes. And yet, only 1 to 2% of non-diabetic patients have such antibodies. So is this an autoimmune response? Stay tuned, and of course, keep reading your nursing journals, such as the American Journal of Nursing and Nursing 2005. This is where we keep up with our research in what is going on. Okay. Now, let us continue with our type 1 diabetes and look at the manifestations of type 1 diabetes. What do we see in type 1 diabetes? Remember that the signs and symptoms are a result of a lack of insulin to transport glucose across the cell membrane. Okay. The first manifestation, the first thing that we would see is hyperglycemia. This is an excessive amount of glucose in the blood. Hyperglycemia causes serum hyperosmolality. This is an increase in the concentration of dissolved substances, and in this case, that dissolved substance is glucose. What does this hyperglycemia do if it is hyperosmolar? Well, it draws water from the intracellular spaces into the general circulation, which increases the blood volume, which thus increases renal blood flow. This hyperglycemia acts as an osmotic diuretic, and so it increases urinary output. And thus, your patient has one of the common symptoms of diabetes, which is polyuria, a lot of urine being excreted. All right, another manifestation is glucosuria, GLUCOSURIA. This is when the blood glucose level exceeds the renal threshold for glucose. When the blood glucose level exceeds the renal threshold for glucose, that is usually at about 180 milligrams per deciliter. And when that happens, glucose is excreted in the urine. The third manifestation or symptom is polydipsia, PolyDipsia. That is increased thirst. The decrease in intracellular blood volume and the increased urinary output cause dehydration. So the mouth becomes dry and the thirst sensors are activated and the person becomes thirsty. Next is polyphagia, or polyphagia, PolyPhagia. This is an increase in the appetite. Because the glucose cannot enter the cell without insulin, energy production decreases. Decrease in energy stimulates hunger, so the person eats more food. Conversely now, what you would not think of is another symptom, which is weight loss. Despite this increased food intake from the polyphagia, this person actually loses weight. The body loses water, and that's the weight that it loses, water weight, from the polyuria. Proteins and fats are broken down then in an attempt to restore the energy sources. So we have a glucose increase, and we have proteins and fats being broken down. Next, another symptom is malaise and extreme fatigue. Remember, this person has a decrease in energy. They don't have that. They don't have that extra glucose coming in. Next is blurred vision, and this is from the osmotic effects that cause swelling of the lens of the eye. The treatment for type 1 diabetes is insulin. The person cannot live without it. Let's talk now about type 2 diabetes. Type 2 diabetes is the most common form of diabetes. 90 to 95% of people with diabetes mellitus have type 2. It can occur at any age, but it's usually after age 40. The prevalence increases, however, with age. Remember, there's an increase in Native Americans, African Americans, Hispanics, and Asians. Obesity, sedentary lifestyle, and visceral adiposity are characteristics. All right, what is this? You know obesity. You know sedentary lifestyle. Visceral adiposity is when someone holds most of their fat or a lot of their fat in their belly. So if a person has a waist of greater than 35 inches in females and greater than 40 inches in a male, they are at increased risk for type 2 diabetes. This concept of visceral adiposity is a relatively new one and one you need to pay attention to. And we'll talk about this later on when we discuss inflammation. Type 2 diabetes is an insidious disease. It comes kind of without warning. A lot of people are walking around with it who have no idea that they have it. So there are many, many undiagnosed cases. The blood sugars of those with type 2 improve with weight loss. So we can bring those blood sugars down, the blood glucose down, But they do still have diabetes, even if the blood sugars are within normal range, and the person can do that with weight loss and with diet and exercise. They still have diabetes. The treatment in general for type 2 is diet, oral agents, which we'll talk about later, and or insulin, or all of these. Let's look at the pathophysiology now. Hyperglycemia in type 2 patients probably results from a combination of two things. First is insulin resistance. Another term we used for this is relative insulin deficiency, remember? This may be related to the diminished plasma membrane receptors on target cells. So the insulin cannot attach to the receptor sites. Insulin resistance is specifically related to upper body obesity. And then there is impaired insulin secretion. This person has some endogenous, that means within the body, they have some endogenous insulin, but not enough. So there is limited beta cell response to hyperglycemia. We also have to take, that's the pathophysiology, we also have to take a look at heredity, because it does play a role in type 2. There is research that has been done on twins. There is nearly a 100% incidence in twins. So if one twin develops DM, the other will do it also. Also, children of a person with type 2 diabetes has a 15% chance of developing the disease. In type 2, there is no connection with the HLA, the human leukocyte antigen, as there is in type 1 diabetes. That sounds like a test question, doesn't it? Okay, some of the manifestations or signs and symptoms of type 2. First, there may be no symptoms. Remember, there is possibly a slow onset. People are often unaware of the disease until they go to get health care for some other problem and perhaps have lab work that discloses this. The major manifestation is hyperglycemia, but it's not as severe as in type 1, but it results in similar symptoms. So the hyperglycemia results in the symptoms such as polyuria, polydipsia. Now, polyphagia is not a usual symptom of type 2, and weight loss is not common. All right, so we have polyuria, polydipsia, blurred vision, fatigue, paresthesias, P-A-R-E-S-T-H-E-S-I-A-S. Paresthesias are numbing and tingling, especially of the feet. And this is from peripheral neuropathy, and we'll talk about that later. Skin pruritus, P-R-U-R-I-T-I-S, that's itching. And frequent infections and slow healing of the cuts and bruises. Also, another symptom, recurrent gum, skin, or bladder infections. And lastly, vulvovaginitis. This is someone who has a yeast infection. Specifically, the yeast overgrows in the presence of all of that glucose. So someone who has frequent vaginal infections caused by yeast, one might think about diabetes mellitus. Treatment of type 2 diabetes. Mostly we use oral antidiabetic drugs. 20 to 30% of patients may require insulin. They usually require insulin when they are under stress, either physiological, psychological, with illness, or infection. So your patient in the hospital is someone who might require insulin because their blood sugars rise when they are under stress, the stress of the hospitalization or surgery. So very often you will be ordered to give insulin to someone in the hospital, and when you arrive in the room, you will say, well, I have your insulin for you, and they're going to tell you, I never have taken insulin in my life. And you have to explain that very often when we are under stress, the blood sugar rises and the insulin is necessary. Also, treatment is with diet. Okay, the third type of DM is pre-diabetes. Remember, we've talked about this already. This is impaired glucose tolerance, IGT, and impaired fasting glucose, IFG. These pre-diabetic patients used to be called borderline diabetics. We now call this pre-diabetes. This occurs when the patient's glucose level is between normal and diabetic values. Okay. They are usually obese, and 7% convert to type 2 diabetes eventually. Please look up about impaired glucose tolerance and impaired fasting glucose, so that you understand these, how we test this. Gestational diabetes mellitus, GDM, occurs when there is onset during pregnancy, and I refer you to your maternal and child health book to read further about this. This is in 7% of all pregnancies. This pregnancy is considered to be a high-risk one, and it is defined as carbohydrate intolerance. It disappears after childbirth, but the person remains at high risk to develop diabetes mellitus after pregnancy, and so does her child. Very important. The pathophysiology is that the pancreas cannot tolerate the stress of pregnancy and thus does not respond to the increased demands for insulin. These people with GDM often have a history of unexplained stillborns. And in this case, the acidosis from the diabetes kills the fetus. They also have a history of large babies, which is called macrosomia. Their babies have congenital anomalies, particularly cardiac, and obesity. There also is possibly a history within the family of gestational diabetes, giving us some idea that this might be hereditary. And also cigarette use features in here as a possible cause. So women with cigarette use have a greater chance of developing this. Diagnosis, the screening is at 24 to 28 weeks gestation, and they usually do a 1-hour glucose tolerance test. Please look that up. The treatment of the pregnant woman. The pregnant woman is not treated with oral hypoglycemics because they are teratogenic, teratogenic, meaning they will cause the fetus to be deformed. So the control is done with diet, and they usually have a bedtime snack to prevent hypoglycemia at night. They receive insulin if the diet doesn't control it. The idea is to try to keep the fasting blood sugar around 105 milligrams per deciliter. At each obstetrical visit, the urine is checked for sugar and ketones. And exercise also is part of the treatment. I need to say a word about the renal threshold in pregnant women. Renal threshold is the point at which kidneys will allow sugar to be released into the urine. During pregnancy, the kidneys will spill sugar if the blood sugar is only 130. So it spills urine quite early. So the renal threshold is lower in pregnant women.
But remember, it's also lower in young people, and it's higher in the elderly. So the elderly tend to recirculate their glucose and hold it in, which does more damage as well. Just a word now about the pregnant type 1 diabetic. Remember, this person already has DM. The DM should be under control at least 3 months before the patient becomes pregnant. Blood sugar, 70 to 120, should be maintained for a healthy pregnancy. Insulin needs and diet will change during pregnancy, so more insulin might be needed and strict diet control might be required. If the DM is not under control, the newborn or the fetus is at risk for cardiac, central nervous system, and skeletal defects. In all pregnant diabetics, there is a possibility of macrosomia, where the baby has a large body. And what is the deal with this? What's the story? Well, too much sugar in the mom is available, so the baby grows and grows. So the sugar in the blood of the woman allows the baby to grow really much larger than the baby normally would be. This large baby is prone to hypoglycemia. Hypo. Why? The baby's pancreas was working overtime to deal with the glucose from the mom while the pregnancy was taking place. After birth, it continues to produce a large amount of insulin, too much actually for its body now, so it depletes the blood glucose 2 to 4 hours after birth. Also, if the mom has advanced diabetes with vascular changes as a result of the diabetes, this will affect the placental perfusion of blood. So the blood will not be perfused as well in the placenta, and it can cause death of the fetus. And it can also cause congenital anomalies. Let's take a look at the acute complications of diabetes. Now again, please go back to your book, to your text, and to your OB book to take a look and read about pregnancy and diabetes. All right, let's do the complications now. The first complication is diabetic ketoacidosis, DKA. It's defined as acute insulin deficiency that causes metabolic acidosis from ketone bodies as a result of fat breakdown. It has a 3 to 10% mortality, seen most frequently in type 1 diabetics. It is a medical emergency. Predisposing factors: first, failure to take insulin. It may occur before the patient realizes they are a diabetic, so they are not taking insulin. A second predisposing factor of DKA is insufficient amount of insulin taken. The third predisposing factor is infection. And the fourth is physiological or emotional stress. This increases the release of gluconeogenic hormones. Okay? The pathophysiology of DKA. There are two major metabolic problems. The first is hyperglycemia. Glucose uptake by insulin-sensitive tissues, such as the liver, skeletal muscles, and adipose tissue, is diminished because of a lack of insulin. So, there is an increase in glucose in the blood. The increased glucose in the blood causes an increase in osmotic pressure, causing fluid to leave the cells and enter the circulatory system. Why are they doing that? In an attempt to dilute the blood. This results in an osmotic diuresis, that polyuria we just talked about. The body is attempting to rid itself of glucose through the urine. But remember that when it does that, it also results in loss of electrolytes, such as sodium, chloride, and potassium. So the body becomes dehydrated. All right, the second major metabolic problem, the first was hyperglycemia, the second is metabolic acidosis. Because glucose is unable to enter the cell, the body attempts to provide more by, remember, the glycogenolysis, the breakdown of glycogen to glucose in the liver. But the body still can't use it because there is no insulin. So the body then reads that it still needs glucose. So gluconeogenesis occurs. This stimulates the formation of glucose from fats and proteins. With an increase in lipolysis, remember that's the decomposition of fats, fatty acid production is increased and ketones are formed when fatty acids are metabolized. Ketones form faster than they can be metabolized or removed by the kidneys. So ketosis or acidosis results. Some signs and symptoms of metabolic acidosis. First is dehydration. Remember, that's due to the osmotic diuretic effect of the glycosuria. So what would the symptoms be of dehydration? Thirst, warm, dry skin with poor turgor. Remember where we check for turgor? Not over the skin of the arm. We check on the inside of the thigh. We check over the forehead, over the sternum, or look at the tongue. If it's a dry tongue, dry and shriveled tongue, the person is dehydrated. Next, we look for dry mucous membranes and sunken eyeballs. Weakness, malaise, rapid weak pulse. So there's tachycardia, and there's also tachypnea and hypotension. These are all part of dehydration. The second sign and symptom is the metabolic acidosis from ketosis. Very often there is nausea and vomiting with this, and of course this makes the dehydration even more of a problem. There is also a ketone breath, an acetone breath. It smells fruity. And there's lethargy, which may lead to coma, all part of metabolic acidosis. Please read that in your text as well. Other symptoms of metabolic acidosis: abdominal pain, and there's nothing in the literature to say why that would be. Blurred vision, which may be potassium or magnesium deficiency. Kussmaul's respiration, K-U-S-S-M-A-U-L apostrophe S. Kussmaul's respiration is very characteristic of metabolic acidosis. This is an increased rate and depth of respirations with a longer expiration. The body is attempting to remove ketones through the respiration. This is a compensatory response to prevent further decrease in pH. So we blow off the CO2 to raise the pH. The carbon dioxide, the CO2, is acidic, so you're blowing that off to raise the pH. There also can be coma and death. Let's look at some of the lab data that we might take a look at with metabolic acidosis. First of all, the serum glucose is 300 milligrams per deciliter or higher. The arterial pH is less than 7.3. Remember that normal is 7.35 to 7.45. There is a presence of serum ketones, presence of urine ketones and glucose. The arterial bicarbonate is less than 15 milliequivalents per liter. The normal is 22 to 26 milliequivalents per liter. Remember, the bicarbonate ion attempts to buffer the excessive amounts of keto acids, which cause the metabolic acidosis. This leads to a decrease in serum bicarbonate levels. The sodium potassium increases. Potassium leaves the cell in the presence of acidosis and it moves into the blood. It is actually depleted in the body as a whole. Remember, nausea and vomiting also depletes it. So potassium leaves the cell in the presence of acidosis and moves into the blood. So when we measure the potassium in the blood, it's elevated. But it's actually depleted in the body as a whole. Okay, treatment. DKA is a life-threatening emergency. The goal is to lower the hyperglycemia, so we give insulin IV. The insulin which we give IV is regular insulin. Our goal also is to correct fluid and electrolyte balances, return the serum pH to normal, and all of this is accomplished through IV fluids which rehydrate the patient and insulin. The second acute complication of DM is hypoglycemia. Hypoglycemia is a low blood sugar below 60. Remember, our optimum is 70 to 100. And by the way, you will see that number, 70 to 100, different in some of your texts. But 70 to 100 is the most common now. All right, hypoglycemia is actually an insulin reaction. It is a reaction which has a sudden onset and rapid progression. Some of the causes of hypoglycemia: insulin errors, such as the timing or the dose or the wrong type of insulin. Another cause is erratic or altered absorption of insulin. Maybe rapid absorption if the person injects themselves with insulin and goes to the gym and starts exercising with those limbs. Or maybe unpredictable absorption from overused injection sites. That is why we rotate our sites. Another cause may be doses of oral hypoglycemics, such as for type 2 diabetics, which are too high for the need. Another cause might be diet, maybe an omitted meal, or maybe an inadequate amount for the meal, or timing errors with late snacks or meals. Another cause of hypoglycemia might be exercise, maybe unplanned activity, when we don't have extra food around or extra insulin around, we have too much insulin. Increased duration or intensity of activity. Alcohol and drugs. Impaired hepatic gluconeogenesis is associated with alcohol intake or impaired mentation from alcohol and drugs. So maybe if someone has had too much to drink or had drugs which alter judgment, the person forgets to take the insulin. Signs and symptoms of hypoglycemia. These are more variable in children and elderly, so keep an eye on these people. But the signs and symptoms are caused by several things, two things. Altered cerebral function, first, due to decreased glucose availability for brain metabolism. So what symptoms would we see in this person with hypoglycemia as far as altered cerebral function? First, circumoral paresthesia, circum, around the mouth, oral. So this is numbness and tingling around the mouth. Headache, difficulty in thinking, confusion, change in emotional behavior, incoherent speech, decreased level of consciousness, seizures, coma. The signs and symptoms, other signs and symptoms are caused by a response of the sympathetic nervous system. I want you to make note that the elderly often do not present with these signs and symptoms. Their sympathetic nervous system is not as finely tuned. So here are some of the signs of hypoglycemia, which you might see in people other than the elderly: hunger, nausea, anxiety, pallor, cool skin, diaphoresis, tachycardia, heart palpitations, shakiness, and irritability. Treatment. How do we treat hypoglycemia? If you are in doubt as to the cause of the symptoms, we treat for hypoglycemia. Sometimes it looks like it might be hyperglycemia. We usually treat for hypoglycemia. If the person is awake, we give them 4 ounces of orange juice. Don't put any extra sugar in the orange juice, please. If you work with older nurses, they're going to want to open up 4 packets of sugar and put them in. Not necessary. That's what we used to be taught. 3 hard candies or 3 glucose tablets. We always teach diabetics to have hard candies on their person so that they can counter this if it does happen. You need to check the blood sugar. Then give a meal with crackers, milk, and something substantial. Improvement should be seen in 5 to 10 minutes. If there is none, repeat the above treatment with the orange juice, etc. If they're unconscious or unable to swallow, there are meds which we give. We give glucagon, IV, IM, or a sub-Q. Works within 15 minutes, and families need to be taught about this. We can also give glucose, a 50% solution, and it's administered at 20 to 50 milliliters IV push. Now be careful here. There's a danger of over-treatment with creating hyperglycemia, so we need to be cautious here. Your nursing care, position your patient to maintain an airway, and you know that's usually side-lying. Remember that glucagon causes nausea and vomiting, so that's an even more important point for the side-lying position. We're giving glucagon, it very often causes nausea and vomiting. When the person awakens, give them a simple sugar, check the blood sugar, and then the crackers and the milk. Teaching, again, to carry a simple sugar. Sometimes a tube of icing from the grocery store is a good idea, a sugar packet, or Lifesavers in order to kind of reverse the hypoglycemia. You usually need about 7 Lifesavers, so you need really a nice fresh packet. Okay, so we've talked about DKA. We've talked about hypoglycemia as a complication of DM. The third acute complication of DM is, now, I'm going to say it slowly because it's quite a mouthful. Hyperglycemic, hyperosmolar, non-ketotic coma, HHNC. This is seen more in type 2 diabetics. The person is usually classified as a mild diabetic and is treated with oral hypoglycemics. It's also seen in patients who are not yet diagnosed with DM. They don't know they have it. It's also seen with other conditions such as severe infection, acute pancreatitis, myocardial infarction, hyperalimentation, and drugs such as Dilantin, beta blockers, and calcium channel blockers. There's a gradual onset of HHNC, 24 hours to 2 weeks. More common in people greater than 50 years, and it's often confused with a stroke. The mortality rate is 40 to 70%, quite a bit higher than DKA, by the way. All right, what are the characteristics? Severe dehydration. This is a fluid deficit of 8 to 9 liters. Second, severe hyperglycemia. This is a glucose of 600 to 2,000 milligrams per deciliter. Another characteristic is plasma hyperosmolality. Remember, it increases with dehydration. And changed mental status is another characteristic. Remember, there is no ketoacidosis with HHNC. Let's look at the lab data that we might see. We'll see the glucose being very high, 600 to 2,000. Remember, we'll look at the osmolarity. The serum osmolarity will be greater than 350 milliosmoles. The normal is 285 to 295. These two lab tests, the glucose and the serum osmolarity are definitive for diagnosis of HHNC. Now, who is at risk for HHNC? The elderly are at risk particularly. They have a decreased thirst perception. You know that their hypothalamus does not work as well. So they very often get in trouble with dehydration, because when you and I become dehydrated, we experience thirst. The elderly do not. They can be severely dehydrated and still not have thirst. Okay. Also, why are the elderly at risk for HHNC? Because their kidneys have a decreased ability to concentrate urine when the body is dehydrated. So they lose fluid anyway. Remember, babies, infants, and the elderly cannot concentrate urine when they become dehydrated. So their kidneys cannot retain the fluid and concentrate the urine and make it darker. So they lose that fluid, even if they are dehydrated. So these two things combine to increase the chance of HHNC in the elderly: the decreased thirst perception and the inability to concentrate urine when the body is dehydrated. Let's look at the pathophysiology of HHNC. It starts with a decreased amount of insulin. Hyperglycemia causes increased urinary output, remember? This results in a decrease in plasma volume, which results in a decrease in the glomerular filtration rate, the GFR. So the glucose is retained and water is lost. The glucose accumulates in the blood and results in increased blood osmolarity. This increased osmolarity pulls water from the cells, remember, into the circulation. And this results in severe dehydration. Remember, the water moves from the cells into the intravascular space. Intracellular water is reduced in all body tissues, including the brain. So what signs and symptoms might we see? Well, dry skin, mucous membranes, and extreme thirst. Polyuria, altered level of consciousness, ranging from lethargy to confusion to coma. We will also see neurologic changes, such as hyperthermia, so their temperature might rise. Motor and sensory impairments, such as reversible hemiparesis, and seizures. They might actually have a grand mal seizure. Treatment. First and foremost is fluid replacement. The fluid replacement is to correct the hyperosmolality and dehydration. We also need to correct the fluid and electrolyte imbalances of sodium, chloride, and potassium. We also need to give them insulin and treat any underlying conditions which might have resulted in this problem occurring. Either the infection, treat the infection, treat the pancreatitis, take a look at the drugs. Any of these might have caused the HHNC. Please look up dawn phenomenon and Somogyi phenomenon and know them, please. They're on page 966 in Phipps 7th edition. Dawn, as in dawn's early light, dawn phenomenon and Somogyi phenomenon. Okay. Let's look at some of the lab tests for diabetes. I want you to research the fasting blood sugar and glucose tolerance tests. There are different hours. There's 1 hour, 2 hour, etc. Please look those up. Now, tests to monitor diabetes management. First test we use is glycated or glycosylated hemoglobin. Glycated or glycosylated hemoglobin. That's HbA1c. Normal is 4 to 8%. This indicates the control of glucose levels during the past 100 to 120 days. Glycosylated is hemoglobin, when we talk about glycosylated hemoglobin, that's hemoglobin with glucose attached. Okay? When the glucose is elevated, or the control of the glucose is erratic, the glucose attaches to the hemoglobin molecule and remains attached for the life of the hemoglobin, which is about 120 days. The rate at which the glucose becomes attached to the hemoglobin molecule depends on the blood sugar. So these results cannot be changed or affected by what the patient eats before the test, unlike the fasting blood sugar. So this person going to the doctor can't suddenly have their glucose in good control for the couple of days before their doctor's visit. This tells the doctor whether or not this patient has been cheating for all those 100 to 100 days and how well they've been managing their blood sugar. It's a very good test. So it's long-term glucose monitoring. All right, the second type of test to monitor diabetes management is capillary blood glucose monitoring. And we also call it SMBG, self-monitoring of blood glucose. This is used by patients with both type 1 and type 2 diabetes. The blood may be tested 4 to 6 times a day, or maybe once daily or weekly. It's really highly individualized according to the specific patient. The benefits of this self-blood glucose monitoring, it prevents short and long-term complications of DM. It also promotes health and well-being by euglycemia, euglycemia. That's a blood sugar within normal range. It allows the patient to respond immediately to the blood glucose reading that they get. So if it's high, they can do things about it. If they're visually impaired, some of the units have beeps or a voice recording of the glucose, so you don't necessarily have to have excellent eyesight to do this. Some of the problems are it is expensive, and the machines need to be calibrated and cleaned regularly. Also, it does not test for ketones. That needs to be done separately. The procedure, you wash hands with soap and water. In the hospital, you use the alcohol swab and you let it air dry. The swab is not necessary at home. Remember, the home is a very different place from the hospital. Lots of different types of organisms in the hospital versus the home. So we don't often have to be as careful at home. Just have your patient wash hands with soap and water. Squeeze the finger for 3 seconds with the hand down and relaxed. Pierce the side of the fingertip. The side of the fingertip has fewer nerve endings than the tip. The tip really hurts. If you go to the side, it's less painful. We need a big drop of blood to cover the area of drop placement. If the capillary blood glucose is greater than 250, we test for ketones with a urine dipstick, a keto stick. If the ketones persist with a normal glucose, then we might have a problem such as DKA, and the patient should see a physician. Let's take a look at the long-term complications of diabetes mellitus. There are lots of changes in the vascular system of the patient with diabetes, and they are thought to be caused by the pathophysiological effects of hyperglycemia in both type 1 and type 2, and that's often misunderstood by the diabetic. They think that if they have type 2, they're really not in trouble at all, but that is not true. These changes in the vascular system can be diminished or controlled by careful monitoring of blood sugar, diet, medications, but they cannot be completely prevented. And that's very important for you to know. Remember that. They can be diminished or controlled by careful monitoring of blood sugar, diet, and meds, but they cannot be completely prevented. If you have diabetes, you are developing changes in the vascular system. Let's look at the types of complications. The first type is the macrovascular complication. That's the large blood vessels, macro. The first complication is cardiovascular disease. The risk for this is directly related to, one, the increased level of low-density lipoproteins, LDLs. LDLs are the bad cholesterol. The risk is also directly related to the decreased level of high-density lipoproteins, the HDLs, the good cholesterol. It is also related to, third, increased triglycerides. Increased triglycerides are bad. The risk is also related to a sedentary lifestyle, smoking, and hypertension. Cardiovascular disease is 2 times more prevalent in diabetics than in the normal population. Hypertension, twice as prevalent in diabetics than the normal population. And cardiovascular risk is also directly related to obesity. The major problem in cardiovascular disease is atherosclerosis. There is an earlier onset and an increased incidence in diabetes. You know what our atherosclerosis is? It's the buildup of the plaque in the artery. Arteriosclerosis is the hardening of the artery. Other diseases which are related to diabetes and to the macrovascular complications, large blood vessels. Whoops, having trouble with the mouth now. Are coronary artery disease, CAD. CAD is the leading cause of death in diabetics, and atherosclerosis is the big problem here. CAD is a major risk factor for myocardial infarction. An MI is 2 to 3 times more common in diabetics, and diabetics have a greater chance of dying after an MI than non-diabetics. Other diseases, cerebral vascular disease. And here we're talking about stroke. Stroke is 2 to 4 times more common in patients with diabetes. The major risk factors for stroke are hypertension and atherosclerosis. Another disease is peripheral vascular disease, PVD. The incidence is greater in patients with type 2 diabetes. It's caused, again, by atherosclerosis, and the signs and symptoms are intermittent claudication, C-L-A-U-D-I-C-A-T-I-O-N. This is a cramping and aching of the calf with pain on movement and relief of the pain on rest. These patients are at risk for gangrene, which starts at the toes and the subsequent amputation. The risk of amputation is 10 to 20 times more likely in diabetics. Okay. We talked about the macro complications, the macrovascular complications, the cardiovascular disease, the coronary artery disease, cerebral vascular disease, and peripheral vascular disease. These are all macrovascular complications. Next, let's look at microvascular. These seem to be related to chronic hyperglycemia, which causes structural defects in the basement membrane of small blood vessels and capillaries. It may also be related to inflammation, and this is under study, and we will be talking about this later on in this lecture. Some of the areas affected by microvascular complications. First, the eye. Here we are discussing diabetic retinopathy. Retinopathy, retina, retina, and pathy disease of, so disease of the retina. This is a collective name for changes which occur in the retina of the diabetic patient. Diabetes is the leading cause of blindness, not baldness. Diabetic retinopathy is the leading cause of blindness in those aged 20 to 74. Let's look at what the physician sees, or the nurse practitioner sees, in the retina in the patient who has diabetic retinopathy. First, the physician or our nurse practitioner will see hemorrhages in the retina. Second, they will see what we call cotton wool patches. These are white patches on the retina. These are areas of ischemia in the retina due to the decrease in retinal blood flow. They also see neovascularization, neo meaning new vascular vessels and development of. So development of new blood vessels which form in response to that retinal ischemia. This can result in bleeding in the eye and retinal detachment, which is caused by traction on the vitreous humor. Neovascularization causes fibrous tissue bands to form, and they pull and cause detachment. So that's how it becomes detached. Another finding on assessment of the retina is macular degeneration, and that is when there is central field vision loss. This is another problem with diabetic retinopathy. And another problem is cataracts. Diabetics are at increased risk for cataracts, and it's thought to be from the increased glucose levels within the lung, within the lens. They are also more inclined to develop open angle glaucoma. And you can read about that in your text, and that will be discussed in class. Another area of the body that is affected by microvascular changes in diabetes are the kidneys. And here we are talking about diabetic nephropathy. Nephrons, as in the kidney, diabetic nephropathy. So watch in your reading, we're often talking about diabetic neuropathy, diabetic nephropathy. Neur is the nerves, neph is the kidneys. Renal failure occurs in 46% of patients who develop diabetes before age 20. It is the most common cause of renal failure requiring dialysis or transplantation in the United States. The pathophysiology of diabetic nephropathy. The basement membrane of the glomerular capillaries begins to thicken. This causes an increase in the glomerular filtration rate. Albuminuria is protein that is lost through filtration involving damaged glomerular tissue. Albuminuria may be present very early in diabetic nephropathy. If it's present, it predicts the development of advanced disease later. A low-protein diet may help this. So check when you're doing a check of your lab tests and you see that someone has albumin in their urine. Think of a damaged kidney from whatever cause, perhaps from diabetes. Okay. Another part of the pathophysiology of diabetic nephropathy is hypertension. The hypertension which may accompany DM worsens the microvascular complications, especially nephropathy. So treatment of that hypertension is a must, because the hypertension itself can actually increase the microvascular complications. So here you can see where compliance with medications is so important in preventing these problems. All right, next, neurologic complications. And here we have diabetic neuropathy, the result of damage to peripheral and autonomic nerves, which is caused by the effects of metabolic and vascular abnormalities of diabetes. It causes blocked nerve transmission, either decreased or no sensation of all, often described as dying back. Okay? The symptoms first occur in the toe, then the foot, then the leg. It usually progresses as an infection, then gangrene, and then the areas have to be amputated. So literally, it starts at the toe and the leg, the limb, dies back.